Welcome to the Daily Wrap-Up, a concise show dedicated to bringing you the most relevant independent news as we see it from the last 24 hours.
Sunday, April 7th, 2024. Thank you for joining me today. For those that are aware of the history, this is the 30 years since, I feel wrong almost calling it an anniversary, of the Rwanda genocide. And I thought it was an important focus today. Now, I had a lot that I had organized. Especially since I wasn't able to get to show yesterday, there was something that I wanted to highlight around geoengineering that I decided to put off because of this focus that really, the thought that I had today when I was thinking about this, I'm having a really hard time not pulling at these threads that relate not even necessarily to specifically the ongoing genocide of Palestine, but just the Israel connection as I'm talking about. And I'm the one that's really been harping on the idea that this is not just about we don't need anything other than what's going on in Gaza to make this the most important story in the world right now. But it's obviously connected to so many things central to, I mean, as an American, wildly central to everything the U.S. government seems to have been doing over the last 75 years. But it's interesting. There's threads that continue to develop where things that I haven't looked further into, or either, you know, things that I've investigated or researched, but not in certain directions or certain concepts. And I see these things develop every day. And I go, well, that's interesting. How does this connect to this other story? It's a comment I've made in the past about, you know, as I was coming up in this, even before I did this show, where I'm diving through James Corbett's amazing work, which if you still have yet to immerse yourself in James Corbett's unbelievably amazing work, you should. And still that he's producing this to this day. But I would go through this younger and realize, like, I'm like, what isn't a conspiracy? Like finding out that these different people are connected to, you know, World Trade City bombings, or, you know, finding out that there's connections to things like MK Ultra, you know, on and on and on. The point is, the more you dig, the more you find that there's a lot that goes on that we, even within the conspiratorial circles, if you want to call it that, people that are curious, willing to investigate, regardless of the partisan narratives, even then you'll find things that people don't really highlight or acknowledge. And my point is that today I decided to go through this in regard to Rwanda. And I was already very aware of things in regard to, let's say, the arming of certain aspects coming from the Israeli side, which for those that don't know anything about this connection, it's probably going to blow your mind, but it's very public. Lots of Israeli media covering this going back a long time, going back even to the 70s and earlier in regard to Israel's overlap with Rwanda. But it gets even deeper than that. And this, again, comes directly from their own documents, goes directly to now provable public information that you can find from Zionist Israeli government documents discussing these things, from arming the groups, from being involved with the development of the group in regard to the dictatorship that carried out the genocide. For those who don't know the full discussion of this, we'll get into it in regard to Rwanda, in regard to actually training security forces. Doesn't that sound familiar that we're seeing around the world, training of other security forces and police and from the IDF, and just finding more and more to the story that I just couldn't put down, to the point to where I decided to put off the geoengineering focus and a couple of other things that are, and I'm still trying to make sure we focus on other things as well, and just decided to make this the focus today. Just this story, as well as other related stories to Israel and how this connects, and seeing more and more that it's not just this one story. It's not just Rwanda. It's not just Myanmar. It's not just Uganda or Congo or any number of other situations where you can prove there's been atrocities, possibly genocide. And I only say that in the cases where you could argue it hasn't been proven the way that it's supposed to, certain metrics, International Court of Justice, and so on. But that you'll find that Israel seems to be involved in these things going back, you know, even to 75 years to the original occupation of Palestine, to this very day, and the ongoing genocide of Palestine as well. And I just find it incredible that this stuff is so public, so easy to prove, and I'm still going to be called a racist, an anti-Semite, for highlighting stuff that I'll literally prove to you on the show because you're not supposed to say it. And I just find that fascinating. And you know, we don't shy away from the truth, regardless of how uncomfortable it is. So let's go through all this today. And a big shout out to Orwell for highlighting the Bill Clinton connection, which really kind of opened this research for me, and as it pertains to today. A lot of this stuff you guys might know, but I'm hoping you'll find some new information here that will open your mind to different possibilities. And so let's start with, I think, about four or five quick little points that I wanted to make sure you didn't miss as we focus on, you know, one general thing for the most part today. That is, I just want you to see this, that there's now another, I actually hadn't seen this. This apparently was on the first, but is ongoing to this day, as I understand it, another airman inspired by, of course, I'm very mad at myself for forgetting his name off the top of my head. If you won't remind me in the chat, because his name deserves to be discussed. I think it actually says it probably down here. The military individual who set himself on fire to protest the Gaza genocide. God, it really drives me crazy. I'm surprised that I forget that. In any case, let me know in the chat, and as soon as somebody points it out, I'll make sure I say it out loud. I'm just not seeing it off the top of my head. There it is. Aaron Bushnell. And for, if you don't know that story, he's somebody who decided to self-immolate. I hate, that's a weird word in my opinion, but to set himself on fire in protest, which of course was regarded as something crazy by people that didn't want to acknowledge why he did this. And you watch the video and his history, and he's very sane, very rational, very, you know, is a person that clearly recognized how serious this was, however extreme you think his actions were. Because my point was, you know, we could have used him. I would have, if I was there, I would have pled with him to not do that, because we could use people like him to keep fighting. But in any case, another airman has now started a hunger strike in front of the White House, which I found really interesting and worthy of acknowledgement, because this is obviously not as extreme and will get less attention. People probably disregard the fact, fine, let him starve himself. But my point would be, is if this person gets the kind of attention he deserves from us, and we do continue to follow this to the point to where he literally starts to get food insecure, even to the point of where he starts to starve, God forbid. The point would be that that is a very powerful overlap. You can't deny a starving person in front of the White House. I would argue they'd probably arrest him before that, because they'd find some reason, because they wouldn't want that to be so obvious, because it would develop a lot of attention if you start to literally see a guy choosing to starve to death in honor or in solidarity with the people actually being forced to starve to death by this very White House and the Israeli government. So make sure you see that. We'll keep an eye on that. Also, turns out the UK is, as they released report, Jerusalem Post, sending a Royal Navy ship to apparently boost aid for Gaza. You know, because Israel's doing everything it can, but we're going to literally work around them to make sure we do more than that, even though they're doing everything they can. Obviously, that narrative fell apart a long time ago. But don't forget that for the first 4 months, we were being incessantly told they were doing literally everything possible, except now they need to do more, because that totally wasn't a lie. Like, how embarrassing this whole thing is for the people that keep lying for genocide, on top of just being horrible, disgusting, inhuman people that are supporting genocide. But also to set up a new maritime corridor, right? Because we need more maritime corridors? No, we need aid to be delivered through the many different crossings, most of which are still actually closed, even though they open two more. So this is just a game, in my opinion, and all of it's as I think is obvious, this is not about aid. This is about the same agendas that have always been there, because the plan for the port was there long before Biden, and it wasn't even his plan. It was Netanyahu's, specifically Israel in general, or I should say in general, Israel's plan. The bottom line is, has nothing to do with helping Palestinians. Now, another point to make sure you didn't miss, because this blends in the background for those of you that are tired of how dumb this conversation is. And I only mean this in the sense of the lies that are spinning around it. Here's a new post from the 4th. Hamas rejects another ceasefire offer. Is that what actually happened? Hardly. And even they, in this article, basically explain it, but they have to make it sound like Hamas refused something. Even though the fact is, and you could frame it as Hamas did in fact, or has permanently set in place that they will not accept anything that is not a full exchange of hostages and ceasefire, which is what Israel claims to want, but then denies that because they haven't gotten hostages back, even though the deal would get them back. But, you know, facts, logic doesn't apply here. The bottom line is that they made it clear, we will not accept that, because a pause, as anybody logical, including what seems pretty much everybody other than Israel and the United States at this point, acknowledges, is meaningless, because what most people in the world want is no more killing of civilians. A pause does not stop that, because Israel's been clear, we're going to continue, and the continuing will continue killing civilians. So it's a really stupid circle here. At the end of the day, they made it clear that was the only real red line, and Israel pretends, as it says right in this discussion, that they want their hostages back. And until they get them back, there is no deal. Well, they go, okay, well, here's a deal for all the hostages. And they go, no. So what they're really saying is we want all of our hostages for literally nothing. Then we'll decide if we want to make a deal. Probably won't, though, at that point, because you have no leverage. But we'll pretend we will, because once you give it to us, then we'll make a deal, and you're the one holding up the deal. That's how childish this is. Meanwhile, children continue to starve to death. It makes me sick that anybody pretends like this makes sense. And Assad Abu Khalil points out, Hamas was wise in rejecting this lousy deal, which basically would exchange the release of Israeli prisoners with the resumption of genocide after 6 weeks. And by the way, it was not a full hostage exchange, which is crazy. Think about how ridiculous that is for the Israeli government claiming they want all of them back, turning down a full hostage deal for half of them. That's why Israeli people are furious about them not. And even 972 magazine has reported that the people keep saying, "We stop what you're doing. We want a full exchange, Stop. And they don't care. Then they lie to the U.S. population, Western audiences, and say the opposite, just like this. But a six-week pause is not a ceasefire. Free hostages means all of them, even though that's not what Israel wants, very clearly. And the aid is obviously involved with all of that. And I wanted to include this, as Javeria points out, Israel has broken 65 U.N. resolutions. It's probably more than that, quite frankly, and with no consequences, of course. Well, Iraq broke two, got invaded, bombed, and destroyed. Anybody confused by that complete contradiction? Shouldn't be. It's pretty consistent, actually, based on Israeli engagement with U.S. foreign policy. But Sam Husseini writes, he wouldn't put it past Blinken and Biden to simply pretend, because one of the main things we're going to highlight today, as we already did a bit before, is this shifting narrative, right? The idea that suddenly, like on a dime, Morning Joe is all big and blustery about how you're not doing the right thing, as 30 seconds ago you were an anti-Semite for saying anything even remotely that. It's obvious that something has shifted. Somebody has decided at some higher level that they're going to suddenly start calling this out. But, you know, 2% instead of 1%. Totally not even close to the reality of the situation. But from mainstream media, it seems jolting. It's crazy to see them shift like this. And I wondered the other day what happened. Who collected and decided what they needed to do to no longer allow that leverage over them to suddenly shift? I don't know, but it's interesting. He simply points out that he wouldn't put it past all of them, but specifically Blinken and Biden, to just pretend to be turning on Israel so that Hamas ultimately coughs up the captives, which he's pointed out this whole time, not like a personal, just in a static information-based way, that if they would do that, that means they gave up the leverage, which means that Israel would go after them, and there's no reason they're going to do that. So these people screaming, give up the hostages. It's just a ploy to get you to think that you're the one, or everybody else but them are the ones blocking everything. I made the point to Fetterman when he posted this again, because that guy's just blindly regurgitating what everybody gives him, it seems. He says, call for the hostages to surrender, or rather the Hamas to surrender, and it'll all be over. And I simply make the same point. Okay, so Hamas, we ask you to surrender. Okay, they've refused your complete surrender for nothing in return. Now what's the plan? Like, let's not pretend like that's not already happened 45 times. They don't want that. So whether or not you think it should happen, whether or not you think I should be calling for that, they won't do it. So now what? They don't have an answer. They go, surrender or we'll keep bombing. Okay, so you don't want anybody back at all. Fetterman's too dumb to know that's the truth, by the way. They don't think they're just regurgitating what people tell them. Most of these people are. But he says maybe offer their BS side guarantees so they can stab the Palestinians in the back. Quite frankly, I think that's exactly what's going to happen. He says, or work with Trump to do so in the next stage, right? Because Trump is completely in the same plan here. Now, as well, the fake return down ceasefire exchange conversation, Gaza ceasefire talks stall, which is really Israel refusing to accept the deal that everybody else wants, and they refuse to allow displaced Palestinians to return to the north. Now, the reality here is this contradicts what Netanyahu's saying, what most of the Israeli government pretends is happening, acting like we're going to allow the reality is they're shooting anybody that crosses lines. They don't know where they are. We've already talked about this. We'll briefly point at it again today. The kill zones, which they deny, which we have on the record, an IDF member acknowledging that. So even Matt Miller, as usual, looks like the fool liar that he tends to be. Here, last point on the opening anyway, Israel reduces troops in South Gaza, Egypt to host new talks. Now, what this really shows me is that there is some pressure being applied, and clearly Israel is recognizing that they can't just do whatever they want. Not that they care, or that they ultimately, and I'm talking about the hierarchy of the Israeli government, I think it's clear that they just recognize they literally can't keep doing this without the support of the U.S., and they pulled their bluff, and they pushed back to a degree, and I think this is what we're seeing. Not that it's going to stop. This is a momentary pullback in order to stop people from, and again, for all we know, that's not even true, by the way. This is what we're being told. But I think this is about trying to pacify, to placate people that think the U.S. is suddenly seeing the truth. And it says, Hamas wants any deal to bring about an end to the war and withdraw of the Israeli forces. Israel has said that after any truce, it would topple Hamas, which it's sworn to its destruction. So the bottom line is they keep pretending like this somehow means Israel can't later go after Hamas. It's not what it means. It simply means a ceasefire, which in no sense of any historical sense is a ceasefire ever permanent forever. It's supposed to be lasting, but we've clearly seen ceasefires violated in every war I've ever looked at in my life. So the bottom line is this is them pretending like this is somehow binding them, even though they never care about anything binding ever. We just saw a UN resolution binding that they didn't care about. So that is another ploy. So they can just as easily accept this, get their people back, and go right back to bombing Hamas. They don't do that because they don't want their people back, or at the very least, they want it to look like they are doing what they need to do in a hard situation. But it says Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that there would be no deal without a hostage release and that he would not cave to pressure. But that doesn't make any sense because the deal is the hostage release. So my point before is him saying, give us the hostages for nothing, and then we'll make some kind of a deal, even though we all know that won't happen. Why would they make a deal when they don't need to at that point? So this is just about trying to pretend like Hamas is stopping it when really it's them saying, don't give us people back because we want that to happen for nothing. In the meantime, we'll keep bombing where they are. Hamas says an agreement must include freedom of movement of residents across the Gaza Strip, which exactly is what we just told you is not happening. It says Israel says an incursion into Rafah area near the border with Egypt is needed to eliminate Hamas. But says Israel says it will evacuate civilians before launching the incursion. So this is the same kind of roundabout ploy. Well, they don't want to leave. They never have. And everybody's been screaming that mass displacement is a crime, even from the north all the way to Rafah. But regardless, especially Rafah outside of Gaza. But because of this whole dynamic, now they've built the pressure enough to where they can go, fine, we give in. We'll help move them out of the way. No, that's not what we wanted. Only you wanted that. So you basically did a whole problem, reaction, solution on us here. Or for some people anyway. Because now they're acting like they're giving in to evacuate them to where? They're not letting them north, so we all get the point. You try to make it seem like you're giving in, but all you're doing is the same thing you always wanted, displacement. Maybe to the pier, maybe to Egypt. You really don't care, it seems. Palestinian residents of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis, which has come under Israeli bombardment, which is ridiculous since that was a safe zone, said they have seen Israeli forces leaving the center, so they're at least reporting they are pulling back to some degree. Medics said they found at least 12 Palestinian bodies in the area. Big surprise, because they're murdering everybody everywhere, and it seems that's finally becoming common knowledge. Some residents from Khan Yunis, who have been sheltering in Rafah, began returning to their neighborhoods after the Israeli troops left. Remember, there's that middle line down, basically not even halfway. It's pretty much southern, but it's kind of down the middle, where they're not allowed to cross back into the north. But it says, Biden has urged the leaders of Egypt and Qatar to pressure Hamas to agree to a ceasefire. No, he's not. He's pressuring them to agree to a pause, which nobody wants, including everybody in the United States and most of the government. But they're pushing for their fake illusion anyway, and a hostage deal. The point is, here's Netanyahu saying, we don't want the ceasefire or deal at all until you give us the hostages. So not even Biden is being, what he's saying isn't even what Israel's asking for, which is usually how that works. Israel is also on alert for a possible strike from Iran. And this is what we'll get into very quickly next, is the idea, and a great article written by Robert, why are we hearing that Iran will attack Israel? So I want to just quickly include this, make sure you read this for yourself. It's what we're already talking about. The bottom line is it's likely. I mean, likely, it's certain possible is the better word, but it's even likely that Iran will decide that bombing Israel is the right response. I don't think that. And I think it's clear. And Robert agrees ultimately that it's possible is the better word. I only say likely because it feels like they're trying to make that happen. And Iran might just feel pressured by their own perceived, you know, societal weakness, as that's usually how we talk about it. Like people don't respond. It's perceived as weak. They don't know. That's at least how Israel will frame it. They might have to. But over the years, repeatedly, they haven't responded to a lot of these goading actions in Syria and elsewhere. They bombed the Iranian consulate, the embassy. That's Iranian tech, legally Iran. They bombed Iran, legally speaking. And so if they did that in any other place, Tel Aviv, I mean, my God, you know what would have already happened. But Iran said, we will respond strategically. They were very clear about that. And that's what they've done before. Waited a month before they respond. And the problem is that that is infuriating for the belligerent stompers like Israel and the United States that would in reverse would already be bombing countries. They want that response. So that's what they tried to accomplish here, in my opinion. But what we're hearing is all this hype. The CIA is warning about all these right wing partisan nonsensical fake news platforms on every other, you know, Twitter and elsewhere, screaming about how we've got inside information. They're already bombing Israel, which turned out to be fake. They're really trying to drive this momentum. The bottom line is it's legal. If they literally bombed Israel based on everything, including what Israel claims as self-defense, that would be a legal response. They bombed Iranian territory, guys. This is as if they bombed Iran. Then Iran would have the legal response to bomb back, and under anybody's context of how this works. And then even more so under Israel's claim of self-defense, they could wait 6 months and respond, apparently. But either way, it's not what they're pushing right now. And even worse, which is actually, I mean, this is almost more insulting than most else of what's happened here. And I mean, like in Palestine, I mean, think about this. Such a public display of how long they've been screaming about rules-based international order. And Israel bombs a consulate, no matter what you're claiming. And all they've claimed is that the generals were there, which, by the way, that's an embassy. That's where they would be. You don't get to just claim they're terrorists because you don't like Iran. So the point is that they bombed the embassy. There is literally no legal justification for that. The U.S. is not claiming otherwise. The problem, though, is they were silent. The U.N. Security Council fails to condemn the strike on Iran because the U.S., well, technically they were silent. They vetoed it in defense of Israel. That's actually what happened. But they're not standing up and going, well, it was a legal strike. It just shows you that they're compromised, or at the very least, they're criminals. They don't have anything sacred here. They're not following the laws or what's the UN. They're just doing what they want while acting like they are, and you have to, though. And in many cases, they'll force you to adhere to things that aren't even the law and claiming that it is. This is disgustingly obvious, and as we've talked about before, this is going to cause exactly what you might expect. Arnab Batran highlighted this as well. He said, just a couple of days ago, I was warning about how the acceptance of Israel's bombing of Iran's consulate was destroying centuries-old norms, even basically adhered to by what you might argue are dangerous countries or dangerous entities. You don't really see embassies bombed that often, and usually the past that we have, you can tie them back to the people that we're talking about today. But it says centuries-old norms around sanctity and diplomatic facilities, and then, boom, April 6th, yesterday, Ecuador invaded the embassy of Mexico. This really happened. This was yesterday. To kidnap the former vice president who sought legal asylum there. The Mexican ambassador was violently beaten and staff were forced out. In legal terms, this is an invasion by Mexico. That's what that is, guys. Now, it's not this. This has been a longstanding reality that embassies are literally considered the territory of where they're from, like legally, in every sense. Is it surprising to anybody this happens right after what just happened? No, they're following suit. And you know what? If as long as they're on the right side of the oligarch authoritarians around the world that seem to be running everything, well, they'll ignore it. Of course, if Iran did this, they'd freak out. They'd call it terrorism, right? Well, here's another example. Alon Mizrahi points out, The Guardian just wrote a bombshell revelation, he says, detailing a method of political assassination adopted openly by India in recent years. And Indian officials admit it. Key quote, the Indian intelligence officials claimed that India had drawn inspiration from, can you guess? Intelligence agencies like the Mossad in Israel, and from incidents such as the killing of the Saudi journalist Khashoggi. You know, the thing they don't take credit for, they pretend they weren't involved in, even though we all know they were. Yeah, we just do what Israel does. So you can't hold us accountable. Do it to them first. Isn't that what Israel's doing to the United States? You can't blame us for this. You didn't care about Iraq, even though we all did. So what's your argument that it's okay to genocide as long as we don't care, apply it equally? Like, it's just crazy. Under Modi, India is persistently going from bad to worse. And also the war on Islam, he writes, inspired by the U.S. and Israel and Western. And by the way, that's also, we keep talking about that. The displacement and destruction of homes of Muslims in these areas. There's a reason for it, because it's overlapped. And the reason I'm talking about this first is because it's the same thing we're going to get into for the bulk of the show, whether we're talking about Rwanda or Myanmar or any number of other extreme fascist or authoritarian regimes that Israel has completely backed, including ones that are borderline or literally Nazi. So this is important to understand, because this is beginning to spin out of control in a way that I don't think I mean, I don't know whether I expected it or not, but seeing this happen in between Ecuador and Mexico, or having India literally say, well, we're just murdering people with no legal justification because Israel does. I mean, how do we not see that for exactly what it is? Now, we just talked about this, and this is my point about how people are pushing this concept of Iran bombing Israel. Literally, it seems they wanted to make this happen through, I don't know, just lies. As I said the other day, in hopes that somebody might just react in a certain way based on the illusion that it happened. But we saw this. Remember, this was this 150,000 following platform called Jack Straw, who's very clearly a ridiculous QAnon follower. But I simply said, I posted this saying, breaking, Iran has started to bomb Israel. That was on, I think, the 4th. And I said, simply be careful who you choose to listen to. As far as I can tell, this is not happening. And I doubt it will, at least like this, in some non-strategic, emotionally responsive attack like the U.S. and Israel governments do on a regular basis. They are far more restrained and measured, which is Robert does an excellent job really going in deep about that. So make sure you check the article out. The point here. Where was it? Here. Is that this is already being spun. This was on the 6th. Hen Mazig. His name is just so stupid. He says, now that Iran is openly threatening to attack Israel. Are they? They're not. They didn't threaten anything. They said, we will attack, but it will be strategic and it won't be immediate. Or at least they insinuate it won't be immediate. But they say, will people around the world stand with the Islamic Republic of Iran? Well, why not? You attack them first. What's the illegal action here? He says, or will this finally be a wake-up call? In what way, bud? Where's the issue here? So you can bomb their embassy and then stand up and throw your hands in the air and be like, victim! Well, yeah, exactly that. He says, wrongly, my gut says they won't. Thinking back to the wave of global solidarity with Iranians during the Woman Life Freedom protest a few years ago, it is sick, shocking to see how quickly we've progressed. You mean that completely CIA-pushed nonsense where they tried to act like Iranians were fighting? That's not what happened. And it was wildly proven. Caitlin Johnstone did an amazing job on that. And we've talked about this, the hijab manipulation. There's a lot of people in Iran that wear that in a protest against the United States, or some that truly believe in the concept and others that don't. And Iran has clearly changed over the years based on policy, based on vote. I mean, the game we play at here where there's some kind of theocratic, you know, like think about what's hilarious about what Israel is openly doing and then claiming that Iran is the problem when they're at the very least, if you believe every claims they make about Iran, Israel's doing the same thing. An open religious run, like it's a theocracy. That's what it is. And that's a lot of Israelis aren't okay with that. In fact, I'll talk about this coming up soon. I just read something showing that the numbers, that there's a huge portion, if not the majority of Israelis that are atheists. How does that even line up with this lie they push about? And it's a whole other point to get into. Either way, his lie about Iran is clearly a central push. I included my interview, the section of the interview I did, or the section of the show that was the interview with Vanessa Bealey right here, if you want to watch that. And I simply, when he wrote, now that Iran's openly threatening Israel. And I said, they truly think we're this stupid. First, in case you missed it, they just bombed the embassy in Syria, the Iranian embassy, for no reason, crossing a huge line. So wouldn't that be self-defense by your justification? And they're not openly threatening anything. As I said before, they simply stated that they would respond. They'll decide what the time is right, unlike the childishly emotional bluster and reactive attacks by the U.S. and Israel. But most importantly, these claims that an Iranian attack on Israel were imminent are evidence-free claims spun up by the Israel and the United States. It's actually the opposite of what Iran said publicly. And it says this is what Hen Mazig is using as fact to make this claim. Typical Zionist lies. Iran is not that stupid or reckless. That's not support or good guy, bad guy. It's just stating a provable historical fact. But that's when this is Hen Mazig pushing the idea that it's about to happen. And here's Jack Straw, just highlighting the kind of stuff we're seeing on this post, on this platform, on this account. I just think it's hilarious. This QAnon is fairly still very real and alive in these people's minds. And it says, I have been told the storm, they're still talking about this, is not meteorological, like a weather event, seriously, but informational. Glad we had to clear that up, guys. And it says, secondly, and this is hilarious, watch the water, which has applied in people's minds to everything from venom and injections to water issues, like everything literal connected even tangentially to water concepts. But he goes, secondly, let's clear it up because this is a meme or a screenshot because, you know, Twitter files. Watch the Water is referring to apparently now a QFS blockchain invisible watermark on the ballots. You see how the what these things mean seem to gravitate and fluctuate to the current narrative that's going on? Where election's coming, so clearly that's what it means now. Next week, it'll be whatever water thing we can shove it into, and they'll all apply simultaneously because, you know, QAnon, trust the plan, right? Lastly, the Trump card is Amy Connett Barrett and the watermarked ballots. Well, so glad we could clear all that up, guys. I just think these are real people, by the way. And this is the guy that literally just deleted a tweet saying Iran was already attacking Israel. And another post that he tweeted and shared. This is the whole stuff we're seeing from the QAnon thing. Or I'm in. It's over. Blackout confirmed. Phase one now active. We need a reboot tonight. Worldwide. Green sky. It's here. All separated by spaces. And then they spend the next week combing through, let's just be clear, wildly assuming what those things might mean and connecting it with anything that possibly connects. And then finally, oh my God, it works. It's like numerology or gematria. It's like, let's just keep shuffling it up until something looks like it makes sense. And then we'll do it again 3 months from now. Oh, that's what it meant. Or none of it means anything. And you guys are still being played by the government. And of course, this post, Trump, Clinton, soon. Really? The locker up where he literally goes, ah, they're good people. They're good people. Yeah, that's going to work. I guess you're still trusting the plan, the 19D chess, right? In any case, here's something else he shared, just bringing it back to the point. Mario Nawfal. You know, because this whole thing of the Q is that, you know, we're seeing the truth, right? We don't trust the mainstream media and all their lies, which nobody should, but they got the real inside information that nobody, right? But let's blindly retweet Nawfal sharing what the government said, because that's the inside word, right? Intelligence officials are sounding the alarm over increasing possibilities of attacks, mass gatherings, and stadiums. This, again, this is yesterday. So that same thing was said like a couple weeks ago. Then it was said again about the new, you know, the Iran is going to do this or that, or Hamas is going to come after the border. They keep floating this out. Maybe it's real, maybe it's not. Bottom line is the government has a vested interest in making sure you want them, that you think they need to be in control because you're at risk. But Mario knows better. Jack, they know what's going on, right? Well, Alon Mizrahi points out, an Israeli first of all, what he posted was, what is getting clear at this unique moment is that Hamas, a small Palestinian movement, defeated not only Israel, but the entire West, all of it. It won on the battlefield and it won in public opinion. It managed to make spectacular use of its reading of Israeli mentality, and it employed every asset it had with extreme efficiency. Now, he wrote this on April 5th. What he says here is, in Israeli media, you can see and hear the realization starting to set in. And it's a kind of an arching point you're going to see over the show today. And a rare moment of honesty is taking place. Now, again, honesty in the sense that what they're saying is true, not that they're doing it to be honest. He says, but already you can feel Israel moving on to the only conclusion its misguided worldview allows it. Right? We see through the rest of the lies, right? So what do? The only thing they can, blame Iran. Iran must be dealt with. John Bolton, Pompeo, they all weirdly jumped to the stage, started going, Iran, 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 like the last couple of days. Why? Now, they've always been doing that, but very clearly in a coordinated way about why this is what Gaza and Hamas are actually Iran, which is hilariously stupid. And he says, Iran must be dealt with. There is no other choice but to take it on. If a small war doesn't make us feel safer and better, maybe a big one will. In the coming days, Iran is all you're going to hear about. 100% agree. It's already happening. So he says, as expected. Like literally after he wrote that, AIPAC comes out on and says, or rather it was before, but the point was that this is what's continuing to happen. Iran backs Hamas, Iran backs Hezbollah, Iran backs Houthis, Iran is helping Putin in Ukraine. It all comes back to Iran. Well, you know what else you could do that about? Can you guess? How about you could do Israel or the United States? I mean, how about Israel backs Hamas? Israel backs, Hamas is the point that people won't want to hear. My point is you can go around pretty much every serious problem in the world. United States backs ISIS. United States backs Al-Qaeda. United States backs Hamas and Israel through that. United States backs the Azov movement. United States backs, you could do this forever. All the groups, how about Saudi Arabia for crying out loud? But because they say, and the point is that when they say backs, I could even go further and say the United States is controlling a lot of these entities. What we're saying is what they want you to think is Iran supports Hamas and their plight against the occupation. Iran supports Hezbollah and their plight against the occupation. Iran supports the Houthis and their support and their plight against the occupation. You seeing a common thread here? Iran is helping Putin and Ukraine. Now that I don't even, that's just a claim with nothing to back it up. I'm sure Iran would support the idea of stopping the belligerent Azov movement and their occupation of certain areas. The point is that this is about flimsily connecting these things, even though at best what they're arguing is that they have an ideological line or a support because they're all fighting occupation and authoritarian, apartheid, belligerent foreign policy. Now, on that very note, let's talk about Rwanda, the genocide that took place, and why all of this ties together. You may not be very shocked to hear that Israel was clearly involved in many different ways before and right up to during and after the Rwanda genocide. So this is what I share with me today, which kind of got me started on this for today. Of course, the president of Israel says in Rwanda, marking 30 years since the genocide, like literally while committing a genocide, you point to another genocide that you know you were involved in. That's the kind of grotesque, sociopathic, psychopathic mindsets we're dealing with, Zionism. He says, I discussed with former U.S. President Bill Clinton, who, guess what, was also involved with at least helping this thing happen, and I'll show you, a dear friend of Israel, he says. Of course he is. The urgent need to bring home all the hostages held by Hamas in Gaza. So you go to Rwanda, or you meet with Bill Clinton about Rwanda, and you discuss Rwanda. No, you discuss your genocide and why you don't care about any of that, or Rwanda, and really just want Israeli hostages back, even though you've refused the deal five times. Think about, I mean, they don't even have any self-awareness, it seems. Why would you post this pointing to Rwanda and then just be like, but our people? I don't even think they realize how bad that looks. In any case, Muhammad Shihada writes, are you there for inspiration on how to do a genocide right? Or to find a lawyer for your hour of reckoning at the International Criminal Court? Which, by the way, it seems, oh, I didn't include that, which I believe that is also something that's happening. There's another country that's pushing for the ICC now to hold them accountable, but I'll follow up on that. But he says, finding a lawyer for your hour of reckoning at the ICC, Mr. quote, it is an entire nation out there that is responsible. It is not true, this rhetoric about civilians not being aware and involved. That's Herzog about all Palestinians. Clearly showing the intent to kill all of them. No way to deny that. That's why the ICJ found clear merit in these allegations and hopefully will be far more clear as the, which sadly will be help, you know, months, a year from now when that finally finishes the investigation. But this opened this up for me, and I thought this was an important conversation to have about both Bill Clinton and Israel and their connections to this story. So for those that don't know, there's a lot around this story, and there's a lot of directions you could go, but the bottom line is that there was political motivations between, well, outside political motivations, but also internally and divisions around specifically the Hutus and the Tutsis, these different tribes, and the ebbing and flowing of control over Rwanda over a long period of time. And the point is that, to very quickly sum it up, and we'll go through more information, there was efforts and outside pushing, as well as inside, flaming these divides to the point of literally on the radio saying, go kill these people. You should kill them. Here's their houses. Here's their license plate. That actually happened, as well as other aspects other than local radio, basically arguing that these people were subhuman, cockroaches even, words that were used, that they should be exterminated. Now, you're going to find it interesting why those words seem to be so relevant when you find out who seemed to be involved with training, arming, and supporting this group right up to, during, and after this all happened. The sad reality is that the numbers are varying depending on who you listen to, but it seems anywhere from 800,000 to even 1 million Tutsis in particular, or in general, but majority of Tutsis were killed. But even the moderate Hutus that were not, did not agree with what was happening, were also killed. So that is what stands out to me, how interesting that, you know, why would the people who saw them as part of their own tribe kill them just because they didn't agree with killing the others? That sounds very similar to what we're talking about today, doesn't it? When Jews will stand up and say, well, wait a minute, we shouldn't do this. This isn't aligned with Judaism. And they get beat up by the IDF. It's like, well, hold on. Aren't you saying that, you know, there's a contradiction there? So let's go into this and talk about what the connections truly are and realize that it's far too similar to what we're seeing today. Now, as Orwell pointed out, birds of a feather, and highlighted this archive. So let's check this out. Look at this. I'm going to show you this a lot today. I didn't even notice this one. Twitter is very aggressively doing this right now. The post is not available. If I refresh the tab, it'll show it to you. In fact, the post is what I just showed you right here. So watch. Frozen the podcast, what you're seeing is the post is unavailable. Most people go, oh, it must have been deleted. Not before they even refresh the page. Refresh the page. Oh, it didn't even show up. Look at that. That's crazy. Let's see if this is gone. Let's see if this gets deleted. Oh my God, it's gone. Look at that. So that doesn't always mean that it's deleted. It could just mean that they forced him to delete it. But nonetheless, let's go through the information, which is verifiable for yourself to check out. So first, we're going to go through the archive. Then we're going to go through Israeli media that explicitly highlights the fact that the Israel government was involved with arming and a lot of other things in regard to Rwanda. Just before people jump to conclusions about how this can't be true, let's realize that Haaretz, I-24, 972, and many other platforms over the years have covered this. The Israeli guns that took part in the Rwanda genocide. Just to jump ahead a second. So, here, I'm interested, by the way, why that got removed. What I was going to say, by the way, is we'll get to another point in the line that isn't removed, and you refresh it, it pops up. And I think there's a very clear effort to hide some stuff right now. But here's the opening page she was showing you, which simply says, the anonymous member of the Inter-Hamwi, Bill Clinton's complicity in the Rwanda genocide. It says, ranked as one of the great human rights tragedies since World War II, the Rwanda genocide is commonly understood in the context of a tribal interseeing conflict between the Hutus and the Tutsis. The event that triggered the genocide is imputed to be the shooting down of a plane carrying the president of Rwanda at the time, responsibility for which has been attributed to Paul Kagame, I believe, current president at the time, of Rwanda and leader of the army comprising Tutsi refugees based in Uganda called the Rwanda Patriotic Front. Now, that deserves more investigation. I'm sure people have done that. Just curious to see where the real connection comes from. Now, if we believe there's more to this and people that might have been stoking this for their own benefit, and the real point comes into when you'll read directly from their own documents that this was about how much it aligned in the mind of the Zionist government with what they saw the Palestinians as, refugees. Even today, as they pretend that's not true. That's the whole point. This entire time, they've been trying to get rid of the reality of UNRWA and the right of return and the truth about why they're refugees, because they have a legal right to return to their lands even after. I mean, the point is that after, because it's an occupation, despite what anybody will say, it's a provable reality based on every international body that has any standing. It is occupied, all of it, and including today, West Bank and Gaza. The point is, they saw an alignment with the Rwanda, specifically the Hutu side about this, because the Tutsis were largely refugees at this time when this happened, and they saw them as a problem. And so the Israelis said, okay, we can exploit this. And this is public information, guys. So my point was, who shot the plane down, right? Was there more to the story about driving this into reality, creating the flashpoint that drove this? Just a thought. But it says, escaping culpability in the media and public consciousness for a genocide, Bill Clinton and others at the highest levels of the U.S. government, United Nations, France, Britain, Belgium, and others share responsibility and possibly complicity for the genocide, which left 800,000 dead in its wake. So let's go to the next page, actually. This part is what's most important. Or is it the next one? Yeah, the next one. So this is talking about the involvement of both the State Department and Bill Clinton in particular and the CIA. It says State Department intelligence documents were circulated on the date. Oops, made the page. Circulated on the daily basis to the president and senior officials in his administration referring to the genocide of Rwanda, meaning they were acutely aware of it every moment as it was happening. And before. It says, for example, on April 23rd, 1994, the year this happened, just 17 days after the initial killing, a CIA daily briefing stated that, quote, they, the RPF, which was again the, where was that? Rapids, hold on. I just want to get it correct. Maybe that's not the right word. Hmm. That's strange. Where did I just read that? There it is. No? Shoot. Well, in any case, it's the Rebel group we're talking about. Now, I just wanted to make sure I said the name right. But so the RPF, which is the group we're talking about that ultimately committed the massacre, they may be willing to meet the military officers and political leaders. However, in an effort to stop the genocide. So here's what's really important. So as we're here after the fact that they did whatever they could or they didn't know what was happening, the point is you can now prove, looking back, that Bill Clinton and the U.S. government were very aware of this dynamic and that the group was even willing to meet to discuss a possible stop what was happening. That doesn't sound to me much like what we're told about this story. Now, this is where it gets even worse when you find out that the U.S. government pulled the people that were needed there. Sort of like any other false situation, maybe like January 6th we've talked about, where in that case they didn't allow people to come help and then blame the situation. But this is another daily intelligence briefing from the Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, on April 26, 1994, called attention to, quote, the Red Cross estimate that 100,000 to 500,000 people, mostly Tutsis, have been killed in Rwanda's ethnic bloodletting. It says, not only did Clinton know about the genocide, he either was aware or should reasonably been aware of the genocidal intentions of the extreme Hutus. Now, you'll see even more so why. Anthony Lake, who had been Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, revealed later, there you go, that the U.S. government knew within 10 to 14 days of the plane crash that the slaughter was premeditated, carefully planned, and was executed according to plan with the full connivance, willingness to secretly allow or be involved in wrongdoing of the then Rwandan government. So does that sound like this is explained when people like the movie and whatever else, that this is perceived as kind of a rising divide that just kind of exploded. But that's not what happened. If it was premeditated and carefully planned, why and by whom? And you'll see what I'm talking about. Now, the peacekeepers numbered around 2,500 before April 26, 1994, but specific pressure from the United States forced the Security Council to downsize that to 270, from 2,500 peacekeepers, UN, to 270. The United States was determined to obviate any real or perceived obligation to send American troops to Rwanda. Somalia had shilled American willingness to send troops for peacekeeping missions since at that time. 19 Americans were killed and one was dragged around the streets of Mogadishu for all to see on American network television. Several policies were contrived to ensure Americans avoidance of the need to intervene. Now, again, as much as this might be a horrible thought, we should ask whether that might have been something that was done intentionally to create that kind of sentiment in Americans. It says one of which was to withdraw all peacekeepers from Rwanda, and the other was to circumvent calling the massacre genocide. Does that sound familiar? This is before, guys, or even the during. Already trying to stop. Why would they care to have you stop calling it that? Seemingly because they were involved, guys. And on top of that, the idea that they would create, literally pull away the forces, and then convince the American population to not want to send more. Removing UN troops from Rwanda played into the hands of the extreme Hutus, whose mission was not to share power with the Tutsis, but to exterminate them. To discourage nations from participating in UN peacekeeping, the extremists killed 10 Belgian troops, provoking Belgium into withdrawing their peacekeepers from Rwanda. And there you get rewarding terrorism. Is that how you see everything working everywhere else? Where, well, they murdered our people, so we just let them keep doing it. Really? Can you see that working in any of these adversarial situations with the U.S. government? Now, that point, you should read the rest of this. It's important, but for time in general, let's get into some of the other articles written about this. Now, this is from 2019 from I-24 News. We're going to get into a lot of corporate mainstream Israeli media, which is why it's so alarming to me how public this is. Israel was aware of violence against Hutus before the genocide. And you know, these are all separate points. When you connect this all, it's obvious. So if they were aware and they funded them, they trained them, and they gave, or rather, armed them and gave them training, it's kind of hard not to see this. And especially when you get into the point about how they knew, how they saw their situation in them and used that fear, drove that fear to support their own political agenda against the Palestinians. It says activists tried to unseal their weapon sales to Rwanda without success. I'll point out something next on that. The point being is they've been trying to unseal these exchange, these documents of how much they were sending, what they were getting for it, what they were involved with. Israel has been tooth and nail fighting since to stop you from seeing that. Why would they do that? New documents, it says, published by Israeli investigative news outlet Sisha Mikomet, show that Israeli authorities were well aware of the racial tensions at the heart of Rwandan society as early as the 1960s. That's crazy. Remember, this is 1994 we're talking about. Sprouting further calls for the publication of records regarding arms sales to the Rwandan regime. Now realize, even outside of like being explicitly, like let's just say people on the ground involved, the idea that you armed the group that carried out the genocide, that's a crime, and that's something the U.S. government has screamed about. Guess what? That the Israeli government's pointing at Iran right now. They're sending weapons to Syria. Okay, well, they're allies, and Syria is not committing war crimes as much as you pretend they are. This is you, and just like every other example, the U.S. government sending weapons to the group committing atrocities. We'll get to it in a minute again because it applies today, just like Israel funded Hamas. You'll find a common thread of them funding the worst people, just like the U.S. government. Now, it says cables exchanged between Israeli diplomats and the administration in Israel show that the Jewish state knew that Tutsis were being persecuted by Hutus as early as the 1960s. This new information is crucial to understanding the way in which the state of Israel could have justified collaborating with the mass violence. Now, let's just pretend that what the narrative is we're told, right? Israel cares about human rights and cares about equality and so on. So why would you then argue that it's okay for them to continue to work with the group that they knew was persecuting people based on their religion, their ethnicity, or their tribal connections? Right? I mean, all that really shows you is that they at the very least don't care about those things, or specifically when it pertains to certain kinds of people. Now it says the new information is crucial to understanding the way in which they could have justified this. I already read that. According to the uncovered cables, Israeli diplomats considered that the Rwandan government's Tutsi problem, and that's a quote, would make them a natural ally in dealing with the issue of the Palestinian refugees. There's really not way, it's hard to misunderstand that. Quote, and then especially when you compare it to what they're doing in regard to that problem, as they see it, of the Palestinian refugees. Very similar, or how they dealt with the South Africans. It's not hard to see these overlaps, guys. It says, quote, they understand the refugee problem since tens of thousands of Tutsis are sitting across the border. Now, we'll explain this more in another article. The point is that a lot of them fled from the 60s forward because they were being persecuted. So you have all these refugees, Tutsis in particular, right across the border, just like Palestinians. They're both in Gaza and Jordan and elsewhere saying, we want to go back to our homes. You persecuted us and you were, you know, and the bottom line is, instead of going, that's a crime, as anybody should, because it always is and it has been ever since and it was then, they go, we're doing the same thing. We should buddy up. Guys, that's literally what happened. It says, and it is well known that they are supported by the Arabs, they wrote. This is their quote. I'll read it all the way through. They understand the refugee problem since tens of thousands of Tutsis are sitting on the border, and it is well known that they are supported by the Arabs. It says there are Tutsi offices in Cairo, Algiers, and it says they're basically an Israeli diplomat said this in 1966. On the record, they get it. We're dealing with the same problem. How do you misunderstand that? And what later happened? It says it has long been alleged that weapons from Israel were sold to Rwandan governments in 1994, although it was repeatedly denied by Israeli officials. It's a verifiable fact. And it interestingly overlaps with other discussions we've had. You know, like the Uzis and specifically the Uzis in this discussion, which were used here against Rwandans, but also the Uzis in the same way they gave to the Azov movement or any number of other despotic regimes, Argentina, Congo, Uganda. You know, we'll get to it in a second. But it says Israeli military officials were involved in French and UK brokered deals to provide small arms to Rwanda through private contractors flown in via Albania. All right, so this is an open report, an in-depth investigation that was done and has now been revealed using their own documents, which we'll show some of them today, that they did, in fact, despite lying about it. So don't miss that point. They aggressively lied about ever being involved to this very day, even though you can literally prove it. Sound familiar? And the bottom line is that they, flown through Albania, so this is obviously a clear illegal weapons trafficking operation, they sent weapons to Rwanda. And they did, up until this time, and even during the 1994 genocide. It says during just over 3 months in 1994, over 100,000 Tutsis and uncooperative Hutus were killed by state-sponsored militias. Now, that number is shockingly low based on every other estimate that I've seen. And that's Israeli media, so maybe that plays a factor. Bottom line is, based on everything I've seen, the low estimates are 800,000, and that's like 90%+ specifically Tutsis and then the Hutus who were not in agreement with the massacre. Either way, that number's far too low. But even then, even say that was the right number, that's shockingly that's a lot of people that were murdered for no reason. But it says the documents were taken out of a trove of newly released archives from the Israeli Defense Ministry. And this is what becomes so interesting about this, is that it's their own hand, their own documents, which shows you why they're just like the U.S. government. They're so desperate to stop these things from being shown. It says, quote, there is no doubt that the state of Israel and the defense of foreign ministries knew very well what was going on in Rwanda in real time, just as the entire world knew. This is the petition to the High Court, guys, ultimately denied on grounds of national security. And the petition was to unlock the documents to show exactly what they were doing. And they still denied it. The point is that this is coming from Israeli government and human rights lawyers who are saying, you knew this was going on, and here's the documents that prove it. And they still wouldn't let the information out. Now, it says Israel exports weapons as well as military expertise and has in the past found itself steeped in controversy after assisting problematic regimes. It's not new, guys. Despite being legally obliged to adhere to strict standards and regulations, which all that means is despite the laws they pretend they're supposed to follow and that everybody else is forced to, like Iran and everybody else, when they flout these and completely disregard them, contradict them at every moment. Pretty crazy. That's just a basic overview from 2019. Now, here's one of the posts, by the way, which I find interesting that just doesn't show up here. Like it's there, but it just says it won't display because the cookies were deactivated. From which side? That's interesting. All it says is this is an Israeli former director general of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Says on International Day of Reflection on the Rwanda genocide, we remember the victims of this murderous chapter in history. 2019. Not today, 2019. The point, these are people that are aware of their history of being involved with not only supporting this, supporting the mentality, arming them. And then here they stand up and go, never again. Sound familiar? Here is The Independent showing you what they were just talking about. So this was basically the conclusion of the attempts to get this revealed. And guess what? Israel's weapons exports to Rwanda during genocide to stay secret following Supreme Court ruling. Does that sound like a democracy or transparency? Why would that be secret? Kind of obvious because they gave them weapons, guys, and that's very clear. Here's 972. It's an excellent article, and they seem to be doing great work in general. I'm glad I didn't even know about them until post October 7th. How Israel helped prop up Rwanda's Hutu regime before the genocide. 2019. Now, again, 800,000 Tutsis were murdered. This is what they're citing there. So, I mean, this is pretty common. So it's odd that article would downplay that so much. But it says, despite repeated requests, Israel has continually refused to reveal its ties with the regime that carried out the killings, despite various reports that claim the Israeli government provided military support to the Hutu regime during the Rwandan civil war that raged until 1994. So not just at the main focal point of this, but up until it. So the 60s forward, or I forget the exact date that the official civil war was raging. The point is that it was part of that. Not a sideline sending weapons in. You'll see there's a hell of a lot of overlap. In fact, I'm beginning to wonder, like the rest of the ones we're talking about, whether this was being driven on the ground for the very purpose of something much darker. But it says, according to those reports, Israel continued sending weapons, including, guys, and again, this is the important part. They'll cite them in the article. But these are literal, provable, cited documents from the Israeli government going back to this time, to the 60s and forward. For those on the podcast, you can read them in Hebrew yourself. Verify them for yourself. And they admit all of this. So it says, these documents, it's according to them, Israel continued sending weapons, including guns, ammunition, and grenades to the Hutus as the genocide was taking place. And again, as the U.S. government was aware of that, and so too was the Israeli government, and even to the point to where they pulled away U.N. peacekeepers. That's disgusting. Guys, this is, to me, that means there was something, there's a reason they wanted this to happen. That's my opinion, but I don't know how you misread that. Now, it goes on to say, yet despite Israel's refusal to reveal its ties with the regime throughout the 90s, documents published below, which can be read in Hebrew here and here, and those are the two that I included, but there's more than that, reveal that throughout the 1960s and into the 70s, Israel was well aware of the severity of the crisis in Rwanda, as well as the danger of bloodletting in the country. Still, it reportedly continued to support the dictatorship. Reportedly meaning by the hand and written conclusions of the Israeli government themselves. Now, again, this goes for everything we always talk about. Please take the time to read all of this. It's very important, but I'm going to pluck out the things I think are most important right now. It goes on to say some of the commands to carry out the extermination, as we just briefly pointed to, were broadcast on a radio station, which apparently was Radio Television Libre des Mille Colonies, which I guess stands for 1,000, I probably mispronounced it, but 1,000 Hills Free Radio and Television, which to me just screams Free Radio Europe and Free Radio, all these clear CIA propaganda talking point or propaganda platforms, or even going back to Operation Aerodynamic and Prologue in New York and Ukraine with a Nazi war criminal at the head. That's CIA operations for you right there. So why wouldn't they set up other extremists in other places to drive their own agendas? I mean, it's what they do, right? But exterminating them. I find it hard to miss the terminology. There were commands to carry out extermination broadcast on this radio station, and the murderers often carried a transistor radio along with their weapons. So this was something they knew would make it all the way to people that were in the action on the ground. The Tutsi, and I mean, like in action, I mean, like in the process of going about their roots, going about whatever they were doing. Now it says the Tutsis were deemed, quote, cockroaches that must be eradicated. Now, yeah, these things tend to be common terminology or terms used when you find yourself in these kind of disgusting circumstances. But I also just don't think we should ignore the overlap to what we already see them calling Palestinians and the overlap to the Nazi terminology. It's hard to miss. Now, it says the majority of the killings were carried out with machetes, as well as rifles and submachine guns. Now, those guys are specifically the Uzis. And I mean, and it's specific in the article and even more so in others that were delivered by the Israeli government. And you already know this point. You know why? Because we talked about this in regard to the Azov movement. Remember this? We'll come back to it. But the point was, Israel has armed other anti-Semitic regimes, which shouldn't be confusing to you today, such as the general's regime in Argentina, which murdered thousands of Jews using the Uzi submachine guns that Israel provided for them. So this is not even new. It says, a look, and the point about the machetes and everything else is a lot of these were carried out by random people. That's the craziest part about this. And it's to show you like this kind of social contagion. Is these people literally, people kill, as the story goes, they killed their husbands, killed wives, and wives killed husbands, and people killed their neighbors. And a lot of these were just machetes. That's what a lot of the average people had. So I wonder whether that was just on top of everything else, and the machine gun was the real ploy. But it says, a look through the files of the Israeli Defense Ministry, which can be found at the National Archives and were recently opened by the public, reveals that during the Kayi Banda dictatorship, probably mispronouncing that, but it was who was in charge at the time during the 63 to 73 reign, Israel was involved in building up the Rwanda security forces. So that just screamed to me. Really? So now you've got the IDF training their forces on the ground and sought to benefit politically from the ethnic divisions there, they write. That's provable. Right? These are national archives that have been open to the public. The links are in this article. The point is the IDF literally went there, just like we've talked about elsewhere in the United States, other places that are acting authoritarian, and trained their forces. Now it says, and the point was, guys, there's overlap in all these locations to, you know, Hutu and Tutsi and so on. But it says missives sent by the Israeli representatives in Rwanda show that they knew full well about the activities of the dictator and the army, which led to a genocide. In a letter sent by Mir Yaffe from in 1968, who I believe was an ambassador, I think, we'll say it down here, to Israel, is an Israeli representative, wrote, quote, "It is possible that it is too early to predict that Rwanda is marching toward a military dictatorship." This is 1968. "Although recently I have been hearing speculations from various circles. Thus, it is a good thing that we are penetrating the security establishment." Yeah, that's the reality, just like today. Security services, youth affairs, a visit to Israel by a group of military officers, a visit by the Ministry of Defense in Israel, procurement proposals. That was, he wrote all those. "Even if it cast thy bread upon thy the waters." So there's more than one point where they say this. Just don't miss the obvious overlap. Now, to be very clear, as we've said every time, that's not unique to Israel. Russia and China and the United States in particular very clearly try to do everything they can to immerse themselves secretly in the processes and policy of foreign governments for their own benefit. That's what they do. It's a crime. It's espionage, but that's, they all do it. So it shouldn't be like, the, I think how crazy it is to say, well, Israel does it too. You're a racist anti-Semite. So it's funny how when you point out the same things everybody else does, like lobbying, suddenly it's a racist point. Tells you how wildly over-defensive they are because they're clearly guilty. The Zionists is what I'm talking about. But the point is, just like with the United States, the main point that seems to be highlighted more than ever today is Israel's Zionist government is wildly, wildly influential to the point of just completely co-opting the U.S. government policy at this point. I mean, it's transparent. It's not about Jews, not even entirely Israelis. It's about the Zionist influence. The point here is that they're openly stating this. It's a good thing, though, right? It's a dictatorship, but that's a good thing because we're penetrating their cabinet, or he wrote, security establishment. So we're going to stand back and pretend that they were fighting against dictatorships because they were a democracy? No, they publicly said, good, let them be chaotic because it works for us. That's the big guys. That should be a written statement to sum up all foreign policy of these governments. Now, it says in a missive sent on December 2nd, 1968, Yaffe asked to receive a report from a Rwandan military officer who led an attempted military coup. According to the letter, the officer visited Israel 3 months before with a group of other Rwandan military officers and liked what he saw. So you even saw it in reverse, where they went to Israel. Quote, "During their brief visit, they learned a lot more than during their two-month training." Of course they did. And we certainly know how that ended up. It says, in a letter from February 3rd, 1969, Yaffe described the, quote, "Democracy Day celebrations that took place a few days earlier." I just wanted to point that out because realize we're talking about a clear dictatorship that carried out one of the most public, most well-known genocides in history, and they were celebrating Democracy Day. So when Israel screams democracy and says, he just incessantly says that like it means it, we all know that's not true. It's same thing for the U.S. government, guys. They're not democracies. Like it's a childlike fantasy that we pretend that's the case. I mean, Princeton does an entire study highlighting that we're literally an oligarchy, proves it with statistical mathematics. I mean, and yet we still pretend like it's, I mean, it's a childlike desperation that we just need to pretend it's the case, or really to make it be more accurate. It's because the partisan paradigm manipulations and the two-party pundits that are have a vested interest in keeping it that way want to keep that the same way. I just keep pretending it's the case because it works for them. They make money. They influence people. Even though it's just like everything we're talking about now, it's easy to prove as anything you've ever seen. Now, it goes on to say the Hutu regime used the guerrilla violence to justify its opposition of the Tutsi who remained in Rwanda, and it says approximately 10% of the population. Right, so this was going over the fact we discussed earlier where basically they were driven out because of obvious crimes against them, war crimes, atrocities against the Tutsi people, and the point was then they developed sort of guerrilla response, which, guys, this is how this works. You know, the idea that you're just going to take, well, sometimes, I guess, in history, but most people fight back, especially when it's an obvious, unjust, violent attack for no reason. But then they call them terrorists, like they did. Cockroaches, just like they're doing Palestinians. And that's not even to say that every person acting on the side was not committing a crime. The point is, this is just basic fundamental things that always take place. And you can see that the Israeli government and the U.S. government lie about these things in spades around the world. Like they're totally not supporting ISIS and Al-Qaeda or acting like the people that they're using with them to fight against are the actual terrorists. You know, it's just this game that's constantly played. But the point was that they then drove them all out. They were pushing back. And the point was they then pointed to the violence to justify what they did. Also sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Oh, they fired a rocket that did nothing and landed in the field. Let's murder half the population. Well, you can claim that you're responding, but the point is that that was them and they're the best they can do, just trying to put up a response to a 75 years of occupation. But it goes on to say, to label them foreign invaders, unworthy of human and civil rights, who, by the way, can be raped, tortured, and murdered. Sounding familiar? Palestinians are cockroaches, they're subhuman, they're all guilty. And of course, they lob this overwhelming case of atrocity propaganda, which most of which has been proven to be false. Meanwhile, you can literally prove rape, abuse, theft, murder, everything you can possibly talk about by the Israeli government against the Palestinians, you know, 75 years, but also since October 7th. They created the illusion that these people were invaders, even though they're from Rwanda. Again, this is, guys, this is like exactly the same situation in the sense of the dynamics, right? They are driven out. They were fighting to have their own home back, which, by the way, they have a legal right to. Then they created a guerrilla response to try to fight back. They framed that as the violence that justified everything. They created and called them subhuman. They called them cockroaches. We exterminate them. They can be raped, tortured, and murdered. Do we not see that in every post the IDF puts up on their Instagram pages? It says the Israeli representatives knew about the persecution, expulsion, and extermination of the Tutsi. On May 8, 1962, Hanna Bar-On, an advisor at the Israeli embassy in Washington, D.C., wrote a letter in which he said that the situation in Rwanda worried the U.S. State Department. Now, you could just maybe consider that there's some people that cared. Or maybe they were just worried because it ruined their agendas. You could decide for yourself. Kind of like we're seeing today, they're worried about Israel's doing, not because they care about Palestinians, but because it's hurting their agendas. It says, perhaps more than any other issue in Africa, they said. Belgium's departure, he wrote, left, quote, this is the Israeli representative, no opportunity for the United Nations to take it upon itself the mission of keeping the peace in Rwanda, Burundi, and that there is no one who will be able to fill the vacuum which could bring about a civil war. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. That was the State Department representative saying that. Now, finally, it says, instead of worrying about the fate of the Tutsi refugees who fled their country, Israeli leaders thought it was wise to take advantage of Rwanda's fear of refugees. You know, sort of like Israel's taking advantage of Republicans' fear of refugees right now, in order to push the government in Kigali to support Israel in international forums on the issue of Palestinian refugees. All right, so they were willing to work with the dictatorship. They were willing to allow people to be murdered and raped and killed as long as they got that vote in front of everybody at the UN or whatever the context was. Guys, that's exactly what they're saying. It's exactly what happened. And we need to see the parallels to the way the world works today. Oh, Sudan, you're a terrorist. Okay. Even though there's no, you know, there's nothing that they're basing that on the fact that they want to use it as a tool. Then they come around and say, hey, guess what? If you normalize with Israel, we'll take you off that list. Nothing changed. So either they were never terrorists and you use that to push them, or they were and you don't care if they are or not as long as they work with Israel. It's so transparently obvious. Working with a group like Saudi Arabia, it's not hard to recognize that these things don't mean anything. And we all seem to know that, but people on the two-party illusion keep it going. Now it says, quote, Rwanda has no logical reason just not to support our position. So they're writing to Rwanda going, you should support what we're dealing with because we support what you're dealing with. It's so transparent. This is an Israeli diplomat in 1966. He wrote, they understand the refugee problem since tens of thousands of Tutsis are sitting across the border, you know, because they were driven there from their homes. And it is well known that they are supported by the Arabs. He said, they wrote, there are Tutsi offices, and this we read a moment ago, Cairo, Algier. Okay. So they support people who are also being pushed out of their homes. That's the same point about Iran and Hamas and everything else. It says, over the last few years, Rwanda has once again been under threat of invasion by Tutsi refugees, some of whom took part in the rebellions in Congo. That's what he wrote. Invasion by Tutsi refugees? Now, even those that fled willingly because they were being persecuted, they still wanted to go back to their homes, and they were framed as invaders. Then you jump forward 20, 30 years, they still want to go back to their homes. And what they do, they took advantage of people not knowing about that. These people want to take from us what's ours, right? And then you get the Republican-minded type people screaming, how dare they? They want to invade and take from us what we've done. Well, the truth is they didn't. They pushed them out, and maybe they didn't even realize that. But the bottom line was they had a legal right to go back to their home. Now, you might argue that things have changed in 30 years. The bottom line was there was no effort to make any kind of a middle ground. They just murdered these people, just like Israel's doing today. It says, on June 8th, 1966, the Israeli ambassador to Rwanda described the conversation he had with Rwanda's foreign minister in order to deal with the problem of Tutsi guerrillas, you know, or freedom fighters, however you want to look at it. The ambassador suggested the intelligence course that the Mossad, quote, would be interested in offering the Rwandans. So here you go, using the manufactured problem. So the people that have been driven out, who are fighting back for their own homes, who you then frame as invaders, call terrorists, you're going, hey, the Mossad can come train your people how to deal with them. We know how to do that. That's what happened. In a letter from October 9th, 1966, Levin describes a conversation with a Rwandan diplomat to the UN in a run-up to hearings at the UN General Assembly. The fundamental positions of Rwanda and Israel are very similar, it says, especially with regard to the refugee problem. This was a quote. So this was, I'll just read the whole thing. He says, I reminded him that in the past year, this is a Rwandan diplomat. Yeah, the letter he wrote to the UN. In the past year, we were disappointed with Rwanda and hope that, hold on, make sure I'm not saying that wrong. Oh no, I did say it wrong. So this was Levin again, who is an Israeli speaking about a conversation with a Rwandan diplomat. And he says, I reminded him that in the past year, we were disappointed with Rwanda and hope that this time they will be able to demonstrate understanding and friendliness. And this is simply in regard to them dealing with Israel. That's all they're talking about. The fundamental positions of Rwanda and Israel are very similar, especially with regard to the refugee problem. Problems, they write, such as the PLO, appointing the custodian of absentee property, like pretending like these are just, we have to deal. They stole the land. They have a right to go back to it. And they're already creating custodians of absentee property. It's the same thing they're doing today. Among other things they wrote, ought to be understood by Rwanda, perhaps more than other countries. So this is them using their divide to benefit Israel in the international stage. This is according to Levin, a representative of Rwanda in the UN responded that, quote, Rwanda will not always be able to go with us on the razor's edge. Our problems are extremely complicated, they wrote, and we demand from our friends to understand the nuances of our agreement, our argument, something that is not always possible. What more, it says staunch allies of Israel, such as the United States, France, and Italy, as well as most of the Africans, have abandoned us. It says, and this is in response, the Israeli representative told him that many African countries with a lesser understanding of the refugee problem than Rwanda's vote for us. So you know how I read that? I read that as Israel pressuring them to come to their side of the conversation, where you have a representative of Rwanda saying, look, we demand from our friends to understand the nuances of this argument. Now, that's not to say that they didn't want to kill these people. I don't know. But what it seems to suggest is there was more nuance. And this goes back to the point of what we showed you here, showing you that Bill Clinton, in particular, pulled back people that wanted support, or that pulled back the UN peacekeepers when they needed the support there. And it says very clearly that it says the groups, the RPF in particular, were willing to meet and maybe stop the genocide. So think about that in this context, right? So here they are basically discussing, like, you know, there's more nuance to this than you're making clear. And Israel simply responded by going, other countries care more than you do. You should care. You understand the problem. Why aren't you voting like they are? Doesn't that, I mean, to me, that's very clear pushing them. You need to care about, you need to hate these people. You need to see them as the enemy. Now, maybe I'm wrong in reading that, but you guys can decide for yourself. Now it says, in a letter from October 21st, 1966, Levin says that he met with Kayabanda, to whom he explained Israel's position vis-a-vis the refugee issue, and told him, quote, we expect understanding and cooperation from our friends, especially from those whom this issue is not foreign. Again, basically saying, we expect more from you because you know this. Guys, this is very clear. This is decades before this really spun out of control, where they're basically trying to align them on the same mindset. Now, at the time, the Rwandan leader expressed his support for Israel's stance on the refugee issue and said that international support for refugees must be prevented, since it is an, quote, opening for intervention into your internal affairs. Now, look, I've just as much as anybody highlighted the idea of weaponized migration and the idea that very clear international entities have used that, including Israel. So what they're basically saying is that, you know, we have to prevent, like, the argument should be we need to be concerned about how that can be used. The idea to say prevent refugees. Now, look, I'll say clearly that a country, if is what the people want and vote for, has the right to argue they don't want any refugees, we don't want any immigration. That's the country's prerogative. The people voted for that. I disagree with that. I think, in fact, even the United States framed its whole identity around the idea that we take the tired and the poor and your melting pot. You know, it's interesting how these things have changed over the years. Regardless, I see this as them coming to the side of Israel's conversation. And it says he asked him to send a letter to the Rwandan Foreign Ministry detailing Israel's demands on various votes and promising that, quote, they will try to act accordingly. There's no way to misread that. Yes, we agree with we come to your policy of the refugees are bad no matter what, and we need to fight it in every way in the world, which, by the way, is Israel's push for Palestine. That's what this is what they were doing on the world stage. And here they are coming to their side. Then they go, oh, by the way, send me over a list of everything you want me to say, and I'll vote yes on all of it. That's what they're saying. Despite the fact that Israel used the Rwandan government's fear, which is what they did, of Tutsi refugees, which then led to a genocide. And they did this to gain support in its position against the Palestinians. Israeli representatives assumed that Tutsi refugees did not constitute a real threat to their regime. Now, it says the letters show that the dictatorship in Rwanda hoped Israel would help it with its relations with its neighbors, Congo and Uganda, since the Jewish state had provided military support to those regimes as well. This is the interesting part about this part of it, is really what they're saying is, you know, that Israel had influenced and manipulated the governments of Congo and Uganda, which they made clear down here. And all this is Rwanda basically saying, you know, now use your influence because we're doing what you need us to help us work with these neighbors that are not okay with what we're doing. It says, according to documents from September 1971, Rwanda and Belgium suspected that Israeli experts were aiding the Ugandan armed forces in their hostilities against Rwanda. I just thought that was hilariously ridiculous because that shows you the truth about what these governments are, both the United States and Israel. Nothing is sacred. They'll drop the Kurds on a dime because they no longer need them. Or they'll, oh, Guaido, you don't matter anymore because we need oil for Maduro. Like, just turn on immediately. Or even going back to Venezuela. Remember all the people that the U.S. publicly spoke to and said, come on to our side. You're fighting for freedom. And then a whole bunch of them fled across the border. And then what happened? They got arrested. Some of them are still in U.S. jails right now. How ridiculous is that? So the point is that in the midst of all of this, according to other documents, it turns out that Rwanda and Belgium had suspected simultaneously that Israel experts were basically arming Ugandan forces against Rwanda, hedging their bets, playing both sides. This is what they do. Anyway, going back to the main point for today, to summarize, the author writes, I would like to point out two issues that seem to be worth mentioning. The first relates to the defense minister's request to send him an advisor who will advise them on the establishment of a security service. This is Israeli advisor to Rwanda, which ultimately happened, and will be able to establish basic courses. That's IDF training. The second is related to the Nahal, or Fighting Pioneer Youth, which it's like a youth training group, right? Think Azov movement, think training. It's the same thing, guys. A paramilitary IDF program that combines military service with the establishment of agricultural settlements across Israel. Very interesting, all the overlaps. Now it says the documents show that Israel fulfilled its obligations. That's important. Aided in establishing a new security service in Rwanda. So at that point, you might as well argue this is an Israeli government, guys. Or you could, at the very least, if you have Israeli entities that have pressured them into coming to their side of all of this, voting for what they want, and now they've literally established a security service in Rwanda, which you could argue they just walked away from and let them, you train them and left. But I mean, the very least, we should ask whether that didn't happen. As well, it says, as in creating a Nahal-style youth movement, which the IDF creates and grows into being what we're talking about today in many other examples around the world. Now, it says the two agreed, and this is the Ugandan and Rwandan ministers, or excuse me, it's the Israeli ambassador and Rwanda minister saying the two agreed that Mossad would provide a security course that year. This was 68. Quote, in the beginning of May, two Mossad agents will arrive to lead a basic security course for the security brass, the leadership, including the head of the intelligence service, over 2-3 months. This is Yaffe again in April 68 about Mossad coming to train them. The Minister of Defense, and realize this is the further back you get. I'm not going to say that the Zionist government are not wildly extreme and out of their minds today, but the further back you get, the closer you get to the original Zionists, like the ones that created, that carried out the most, the Nakba, right? 800,000. I mean, the reality of the most grotesque things, a lot of these carryover atrocity narratives, like cutting a woman's stomach open, putting a baby in the oven, these are things from what they did during those Nakbas. You could prove this. So the bottom line is, these people in 68, the Zionists this time, you could argue, were far more in line with that kind of mindset. Or, you know, I could be wrong, but it's hard not to see that the closer you get to that, you could argue at the very least, they might have been more extreme in that way. The point is, it's 68, and they're then going to train these people. And then later, they carried out a genocide. So you could think of that through for yourself. It says, the Minister of Defense and head of the security services repeatedly said they would be happy had the Mossad left an advisor to the security head for a period of a year or two. And says, of course, personally, the writer says, I would recommend doing so with all of my, oh no, this was the quote, sorry. It's saying, basically, this is the Yaffe again, excuse me, I'm sorry, I keep mixing up the quotes. The Israeli representative saying that they'd be happy if Israel left a Mossad advisor for us. And it says, of course, personally, I would recommend doing so with all of my heart, since the position allows us to penetrate and influence the nerve. So that's Israel saying that, guys. The Israeli representative, again, saying on the record, allows us to penetrate and influence the nerve center of the state. I mean, if you said it today, right, foreign influence or whatever, you know, all the things we keep hearing about. Well, yes, it's exactly what it is. So what they do right now is what they're doing in the United States, they're doing everywhere. And all the other government's doing it too. Just make it clear that they said this. They did this. How are we going to pretend that going forward, they weren't aggressively influenced by the Israeli government? It says, I hope that the Rwanda defense minister, as well as the delegation of Rwanda officers on their visit to Israel, will deepen their willingness to cooperate with Israel, which they did. Rwandans will ask for a permanent advisor to the security services, which is ultimately what happened. Now, it says the Nahal plan went off without a hitch, and this is the youth training part of it. On June 9th, 1971, Harari described how the Israeli Defense Ministry sent IDF officers to establish the Nahal-style youth movement in various camps across the country. So now at this point, we're in the 70s, and you clearly have Mossad IDF training of their brass, their high-level people. You've got people that stayed behind to essentially maintain the security state, whatever you want to call that. Then you've got them going to train the youth. How do you not see this influencing what happened? Now, Harari described how the Israeli Defense Ministry sent them to establish this youth, this movement in various camps across the country. And a year earlier, in 1970, he wrote that Israel had submitted reports to the Rwandan Defense Minister on the progress of the Nahal project, despite the fact that in 1968, in a letter to Major Menchim Baram, Harari wrote that the Nahal training activity had suspiciously moved from the border areas to a military camp near the capital. To me, that simply highlights exactly what it looks like, which is the further infiltration at the core by the Israeli government. It says this was not simply about training Rwandan army officers in Israel. Training by the Israeli Mossad and building a Nahal movement in Rwanda. On June 14, 1968, director of the African Division of the Israeli Foreign Ministry, Hanan Bar-On, wrote that the Hutu regime had actually asked to purchase mortars and ammunition from Israel, as well as to bring Israeli artillery instructors to Rwanda. A specific and verifiable on-the-record direct ask by the Hutus to bring them training and weapons, which, by the way, you see that in a general example anyway. And especially because the leading entity at the point was the Hutu movement. But either way, I don't know how you disregard all of this. Then it goes on to say, in an overview prepared, on October 8th, 1971, a year and a half before the military coup that overthrew the leader at the time, Harari correctly predicted that the only person who could replace the dictator was his defense minister, who ultimately did replace them. That is how you pronounce that, Habyarimana. The newly released documents, however, provide no answer to the question of Israel's ties with Habyarimana's regime until the genocide. These documents have yet to be released. But I think thus far it's very clear to see the connection between the Hutus in general, the core of the government from back in the 60s, all the way to the youth movement that later became the military. The point is clearly when this person who was working with Israel, by the way, was overthrown by a military coup, possibly by their, who knows, you could argue U.S.-Israeli overlap right there. And that would make sense, especially since the person who became the defense minister was the person who he correctly predicted would be the one to replace him. I just find all of this to be a little bit too obvious. Now, it finishes by pointing out, recent years have seen a number of legal proceedings in Israel alongside genocide researcher Professor Yair Oron demanding the defense ministry's documents on defense exports in the 1990s to the Hutu regime be exposed. Now, to be clear, those exist. So it's not a question of how much or what it happened. It's a question of how much. It's a question of exactly the timing. But it's known this happened. Those same proceedings have sought to prosecute Israelis complicit in genocide and crimes against humanity. Interesting how the times go along. Like, it's amazing how we can jump from this to today, and it's like it's all relitigated. How dare you accuse them of exactly what happened before? It's the memory, because of people's constant fear of anti-Semitism, have allowed these things to drift away. Finally, that seems to be changing. I mean, the fear of unjust accusations of anti-Semitism. Now, it says, Director General of the Defense Ministry, David Ivery, ordered the freezing of Israeli security activity in Rwanda on April 12th, 1994, 6 days after the beginning of the extermination of the Tutsi, claiming that only then did he receive information about the outbreak of the civil war. Which, don't forget, we can prove today that they knew that that was happening. We can prove that they were acutely immersed with this government in general. But the point is, both U.S. and Israeli documents show that they were very aware this was all happening. So in 1994, while it was happening, the Israeli government stood up and made a big flashy show of saying, we didn't know. We're gonna stop this all right now because we didn't know. And now you can look back and prove that they did know. So why would they make a big flashy statement? Because they wanted you to think that they weren't involved. Pretty damn simple. The documents published here for the first time regarding the 1960s and early 70s confirm that Israel and its representatives knew for decades about the murderous, racist, and corrupt character of the Hutu regime in Rwanda. I'm going to go ahead and argue from further than that, that they created that sentiment, or at least inflamed it, stoked it for their own benefit, which is very clear. Apparently, it says this did not interest them, stopping this. Perhaps they had more important interests to tend to, such as securing votes in international forums. Clearly, 972 Magazine sees it. Although the Supreme Court has banned the publication of documents from the time of the genocide in Rwanda, showing you that they're clearly hiding that information, on the grounds that, get this, doing so will harm Israel's security and foreign relations, which we just talked about this, the 5758 endeavor. The point is, Israel's got a policy that you're not allowed to talk about this stuff because it will hurt their public standing. And all they do is lock every crime behind a wall. Not even journalists, most can, they've spoken about it on 972. They said, basically, we can't have access to this because they block this stuff. I mean, I did a whole segment on that. So here it is again, on the grounds that doing so will harm their interests, because it'll show that they committed genocide or stoked genocide or supported people that commit genocide. It says there is no doubt that public awareness of Israel's shameful involvement in Rwanda has increased considerably in recent years. The full details of that involvement are still unknown, and we'll find out more, since some foreign ministry documents, as well as all related documents belonging to the defense ministry, the IDF, the Mossad, and the Shin Bet, are still hidden from the public. There is no doubt, however, that involvement was ongoing. That's a powerful way to end that, when you realize that means past it, afterward, meaning they don't care about the genocide, just like they don't care that they're committing genocide today. In fact, I again argue that based on historical actions in South Africa and the apartheid and the ethnic weapons they were committing, all the stuff that we can prove they were doing, all it does is speak to the idea that it's hardly likely that this was pushed to reality, that they stoked what was already happening for their own benefit. Now, please take the time to read through this, especially if you read Hebrew, but the information around this. Now, here is just a Haaretz article. This one is from 2015. The Israeli guns that took part in the Rwanda genocide. Publicly discussed. Here is an article from the 2023. This is from the New Republic. It's entitled, Israel Arms the World's Autocrats with Weapons Tested on Palestinians. Two stories that we've talked about. The Palestinian Laboratory, it terms it, outlines how Israel sells its, quote, battle-tested, field-proven weapons. We've talked about that so many times. And spyware to practically anyone, no matter how malevolent. That's so weird. That's just so weird how you get like, two words get mixed in your head. In any case, evil, bad. The point is, it's an open secret, like so many others. They bomb Palestinians like they're doing now with new and experimental weapons and chemicals and biologics. We've proven this. White phosphorus, all sorts of illegal weapons. And then they go out and they sell them in black markets as well as publicly to people as battle tested. I've shown you videos where they proudly display that. And you ask, and it's been used nowhere but Palestine. That's disgusting. The point is, without question, all around the world. Great article, by the way. Read the whole thing. Let's read a couple points. It says, at the onset of this murderous 100-day campaign in regard to Rwanda, the United Nations discouraged international involvement, labeling it as an internal conflict. Think of how relevant that is today, right? Internal conflict, huh? Right? Like, think about the idea. Now, the UN has obviously shifted its tune today, but just realizing how long that's been happening. Now, it says that summer, President Bill Clinton, who had dragged his feet despite the local U.S. embassy warning of impending massacres, again, showing you how many ways they knew this was coming, finally asked Congress for $320 million in relief. And Yossi Sarid, Israel's Minister of Environmental Protection, arrived in Rwanda with a medical aid delegation to visit survivors. That's after being involved, guys. It says, Sarid's gesture, however, was all for show, according to journalist Anthony Lowenstein. Why? Because, quote, both before and during the genocide, even after much of the world enacted an embargo, the Israeli government had sent weapons to the Hutu forces. Guess what? Uzi machine guns. The same point. And Galil assault rifles, both of which were used to kill people. I still think the machete was only an add-on from people that just had them. Most of this was created by the guns that they put in people's hands. I should say most, because it seems like the numbers ended up where most of the deaths were machetes. But I genuinely think that this was, you can't ignore the overlap where they gave these weapons exactly the ones that in part, two of the three things that were used ended up being the killing tools. And grenades and ammunition in several shipments worth millions of dollars before, during, and after. And then, showed up and acted like they were there to support them. Just like the faux humanitarian aid discussions we're seeing today. Now, it says this wasn't the first time, nor was it the last, that Israeli weapons and tech fell into malevolent hands. In his searing account, entitled The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World, Lowenstein examines Israel's modern war exports to Augusto Pinochet's fascist junta in Chile, one of the most repressive regimes that we talk about in history, the repressive Shah of Iran, which, by the way, was a proxy element backed by U.S. and Israel, Operation Ajax. We can literally prove that today. The Guatemalan genocide, where the country's right wing called openly for the Palestinization of indigenous Mayans. And more recently, authoritarian regimes in Russia, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Hungary, India, Azerbaijan, which earlier this year ethnically cleansed thousands of Armenians from its southwest. You realize this is the most obvious thread we can see. Just like the U.S. government, they support the worst of the worst. They support the ones committing genocide. They support the ones committing war crimes. They support the ones using starvation as a tool of war, because that's who they are. It's just time that we see that, guys. Now, there's much more in there if you read, but for time, I'll leave it there. Here's Al Jazeera. Israel maintains robust arms trades with rogue regimes, such as Myanmar, which is conducting a textbook ethnic cleansing of its Rohingya minority. And they're among the beneficiaries. Now, this was 2017 when that was written. Human rights activists are stepping up efforts to expose Israel's long and covert history of supplying weapons and military training to regimes while they actively commit massacres, ethnic cleansing, and genocide, like Rwanda. The issue of Israel's trade with rogue regimes has been thrust into the spotlight again after revelations that it is sending weapons to Myanmar in defiance of a U.S. and European arms embargo. But nobody cares, right? Because Israel can do what it wants, apparently. Well, I'll include some articles. This one is from Tony Carlucci, 2017, Shifting Blame as a U.S. Agenda Unfolds in Myanmar, and a more recent one by Robert from 2021. Myanmar is in the headlines, but the genocide there is not. I mean, it's obvious why. I mean, the obvious overlap of the it's good when we do it and it's bad when you do it, right? That it's this isn't genocide because we're supporting them, we're arming them. It's just disgusting. And it's an ongoing and obvious reality. We can talk about all sorts. I might have even included it. No, I don't think I did, but Papua New Guinea, more specifically West Papua, in regard to how we have an overlap there with the U.S. and Israel and the ignorance of that topic. I mean, you could show these literally anywhere, but you can get abstract and show the weapon sales and the support and the blind ignorance to what's happening when it's your allies that do it. But let's put that aside, because what we're talking about today are provable examples. I mean, like the receipts showing you that these are armed before, during, and after as they're committing genocide. And then they'll stand up and act like they are against the bad actions. The truth is, the United States, or rather the West at large, allow Israel to get away with genocide, as it is right now. A great article from the Electronic Intifada, which you should check out. Now, on this last arm of this segment, I just wanted to reiterate this point, because it's interesting that we just talked about it. Now, think about how this then folds back into that larger point. I mean, the real crazy part about it is how, for people that don't know anything about this, that they would reflexively dismiss it. That's not true. That Israel wouldn't arm Nazis. Well, yeah, they would. They wouldn't. They'd arm any level of extremist element, just like as we've talked about in this very show, as you can prove, even on Wikipedia, that Zionism, before the state of Israel, aligned itself with Nazi Germany, and even after the Final Solution. Tried at least at one time to align themselves with Stalin. The point is they wanted a fascist entity to be able to control. And they were willing to, even as the CIA wrote, sacrifice the Arab Jews in the world to get what they wanted. That was a CIA document. I've talked about all of this. The point here, in 2018, human rights groups were demanding Israel stop arming neo-Nazis in Ukraine. So if you are confused by any of it, it's simply that they will put weapons in the hands of literally anybody to get what they want, just like the United States. In fact, the worst, and the points that are relevant here to the larger conversation, it says, nevertheless, this is not the first time in which the defense establishment is armed forces that embrace fascist ideologies or Nazi ideologies. The Israeli government. And this is Haaretz highlighting that this is not the first time they've done that. It says in the past, they've armed anti-Semitic regimes like the general's regime in Argentina, which we didn't even mention the other one. I know we jumped ahead, but the point is, in the bulk, we didn't even get into that. Which murdered thousands of Jews in camps while its soldiers stood in watchtowers guarding the prisoners with Uzi submachine guns that were provided by Israel. According to the Freedom of Information petition, the Israeli Defense Ministry from last January, Israel also armed Bolivia's military regimes, knowing that Nazi war criminal Klaus Barbie was part of that regime. Legal documents used to convict the head of the junta also showed that Barbie's death squads used those same Israeli Uzis. I mean, it's just so stupidly obvious. And then again, to highlight this with the reality that they're currently saying Russia and Hamas are somehow going to, after if you let them win, they're going to march around the world. There's literally no indication to make that. They say opposite. Of course, they could lie. But other than that, there's no reason. There's nothing that suggests that would happen. Now, conversely, both the Azov movement and Israel are two entities that are actually saying that. But this one is about specifically the Azov movement. I've talked about it before. The Azov movement's founder, one of them anyway, it says, our nation's historic mission at this critical juncture is to lead the final march of the white races to its survival. This is a march against subhumans who are led by the Semite race. That's what it literally says. Israel funds them to this very day, arms them. Public. This is why arms group or rights groups were going, why are you doing that? They even stood up and said, how dare you? Zelensky's Jewish. Guys, it's so stupidly public. The bottom line is, if they're the ones actively saying that, it's kind of interesting to see that they're the funding the ones that are, in fact, actually embodying this ideology while throwing this at every one of their adversaries. It just couldn't be more clear. Now, here's a really interesting point, talking about Rwanda or any other discussion about other foreign countries, in this case, specifically Africa. It says, criminal and Zionist prime minister of Israel press conference regarding his plans for occupation of Africa. Well, to be very, very accurate, he's simply talking about what he frames as helping or going to Africa, but we all know how that will work. So think about how interesting it is that this post is him discussing, after I finish Palestine, I'm going to Africa. And just all, what it really shows you is that exact design. We just pretend it's not what he's saying.
After I liberate the Jewish people, I will go to Africa to help liberate the black people.
Video footage of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talking about Israel's goals for Africa in a press conference in Uganda has many on the continent speculating what those plans and goals are. Will Africa be Israel's next target after they completely dominate Palestine?
Now, that goes on. I just wanted to play that first part of it. I just find that hilariously obvious. What do you mean you're going to go? So you won't even give full, like you'll treat Ethiopian Jews like they're pariahs, like they're not part of your society, despite pretending it's for the Jews alone. It's very clear what that means, right? Obviously, or we just discussed the Jewish convert who was a Palestinian who you killed in cold blood because he stood there in the wrong place. Right. The idea is very clear that you're going to liberate the black people. Like, that's insultingly disgusting. You do not care about that. It's clearly about, one, the obvious Greater Israel project, which takes up the northern part of Africa for it's crazy. If you haven't looked into the Greater Israel project, which is a very public and real thing, it includes parts of the Middle East, parts of Africa, it's crazy. That's their plan. And that's what they're pretending everyone else is doing that. And Zionists is what I'm talking about. In any case, I just find that really, really telling. Now here, just to finish the segment, I think of how crazy it is after all we just discussed, for those that probably knew it already, it's not shocking, but then taking it back to the reality that even the current situation was also funded and armed by the Israeli government. Aretz telling you that they were very clearly saying anyone that wants to stop the two-state solution, which is what they claimed they wanted, needed to bolster Hamas, transferring money to Hamas. I mean, how do you think they buy weapons, guys? Money. And the idea that was ever for humanitarian aid is such a, it's such a manipulative, it's playing on the ignorance of people. If you have to deliver aid to the point to where it's 500 plus trucks a day and they're still food insecure before October 7th, which it is, and it was, are you arguing you're going to give them money to buy aid when you can't even get anything without it being delivered in? Like, that's such an obvious game. They gave them money so they could buy weapons, and that's a public reality at this point. Here's even the Mossad, or the article from Haaretz. Mossad chief visited Doha, urged Qatar to continue arming Hamas. And again, here's the clip that shows you even the former prime minister making sure you understand that and exactly what it being very clear about why.
So are you saying Benjamin Netanyahu deliberately boosted Hamas to try to prevent a Palestinian state?
Yeah, sure. He deliberately and systematically even told, is on record, whoever wants to avoid the threat of a two-state solution has to support my policy of paying protection money to the Hamas.
So what we did, with the permission of our prime minister, is to let Qatar to transfer a huge amount of money in cash, probably more than $1.4 billion. By doing it, we increased the power of Hamas. We did everything in order to make sure that Hamas will go on controlling Gaza, and Palestinian Authority will control the West Bank, so they will fight each other.
Netanyahu maintains the Qatar money was to...
And he goes on to say, for humanitarian aid. And that's why I said that first. Because it's a ridiculous illusion to pretend like you could use that money to buy aid in a place where you can't get it without it being delivered to you. It's just so absurd. To all that being said, it's just the most obvious thing in the world that the Israeli government funds the most dangerous people and then uses their presence to justify their actions, you know, just like the U.S. government. And it has been responsible behind arming the worst atrocities that we know of, including aligning itself with Nazi Germany. I just don't know how we can ignore this stuff. And I'll include this because it's important to understand that this is not my personal opinion, that you can read this on Haaretz's own article, like a lot of this stuff, that the Lehi Party, which is a foundational part of the Zionist movement, continued to seek an ally with Nazi Germany even after the Final Solution began. So for you, for those acting like the entirety of Israel was created to defend against those things, that should be confusing for you. And I hope, if it's confusing, that you continue to probe that point and research and interrogate it for your own investigation, for your own knowledge. Otherwise, you don't really care about the truth. Now, I want to continue on. I'm trying to decide if I want to go off of some other points and just leave it there. I think it's important that that topic is seen. But The Nation put out a good article called "The Ghoulish Ostentatiousness of Israel's Latest War Crimes." It's a good article, April 4th, and it's just simply highlighting how crazy all this is, how clear and vivid and provable. The last few days of Israel's war on Gaza have been too hard to bear. In quick succession, the world watched them withdraw from al-Shifa, revealing stomach-churning scenes of death and destruction, bomb an Iranian embassy, kill 7 humanitarian workers. And they're just so obscenely obvious. That's why things have shifted. And unfortunately, it took a bunch of 7 people from another country to kill there. And, you know, Biden claiming this guy is a friend to suddenly care, even though I don't even then think that they care. The truth is, they're very aware that we see them. Now, I just want to show you a couple of things that are horrifying that I think are important to recognize. All these family members that you're going to see in this video have suffered burns, most of them children, as a result of being bombed with U.S. manufactured bombs in Gaza. And as I understand it, their families, the rest of their family are dead now. And these are the ones that are left, and they're all mutilated, essentially, because they were burned. It just makes me sick. How do we pretend that these are these Hamas members? They already told you. It doesn't matter, because we now know they kill civilians blithely. But they said that's international law, apparently, according to the leaders of international law, or how, as we're told. The truth is, they're not. The U.S. government and the rest of them are ridiculous. They're pretending to be these things. Now, I can't speak with any true insight to whether other governments might be better, because truly, I question all of them. But I can prove to you that the actions that other governments are currently taking are monumentally better than this. I just always wonder whether that's just a means to an end to end up doing the same thing. But call me jaded. I am. Nonetheless, you can't look at this and pretend that the U.S. and Israel are in any way on the right side of history. It should sit with you guys. It should bother you. Here is James Elder from UNICEF. As he said, just I think this should hold weight. And you know my skepticism toward the body of the UN, not necessarily every individual, or rather, I mean, I'm skeptical and I question everybody all the time, including people I trust. My point is that as I'm skeptical of the UN in general, just to always state that. But nonetheless, this individual has said it's the worst he's seen in his 20 years of doing this. It's a horror story for children, he said.
Despite another night, another day, relentless bombardments here, children still play. This is Rafah. This is a city of children. This is where children and families were told to come. This is where they were told they'd be safe.
Safety? This word doesn't really exist in Gaza, but loss does. So many loved ones lost. Countless homes lost. Mums and dads who spent their entire lives saving the family home, only to lose it in a single strike, and now forced to live in a flimsy tarpaulin. Every day, even with the fear, the hungry bellies, parents try to give their children hope. Hope. Another word that risks being scratched from the dictionary in Gaza. Rafah, a city of children, 600,000 girls and boys, but where a military offensive is threatened to take place.
And so for the... God, just think about how crazy the stark that is. So obviously we've been telling you the whole time that half the population is under 18, right? But realize that what he's telling you here is that 600,000 of the 2 million people here are children. And they're bombing all the time. That's why the number of children get killed going up thousands every month. I mean, it should really, really make you upset that anyone in the world pretends like this is justifiable.
Those beyond these border walls, for those who can feel the pain and the fear of parents here, for those who believe a child is a child, please just make it stop.
You can hear the pain in his voice. You can hear him breaking. There's a guy that does this for a living. You can see the suffering. Imagine being there and having to look those people in the faces.
What else is there to say? This is Selma, little girl, she's five. Selma is five. Journalists, the journalists are banned from covering what's happening here to children. Journalists will often ask me, is what's happening to children here the worst thing I've seen in my 20 years with UNICEF? For UNICEF, for myself, a child is a child. That's why we work around the world. That's why I've got these incredible colleagues on the front line from Afghanistan to Ukraine, Haiti to Ethiopia, doing immense work for children in great need. What for me makes Gaza a little different is everywhere I turn, there is another Selma. This ICU is full of children with the wounds of war. Sometimes I will return here and the next day there is a different child in a bed because the child I saw the day before has not made it, despite the heroics of these doctors and nurses. So this horror story for children, it has to end, okay? These children, Selma, and so many like her, they need a new story. Humanity must write a different chapter for these children.
Just so sad how hard some of these people are trying to reach people's humanity when sadly a lot of the people they're trying to reach seem to have none. Derek Brose, not Derek Brose from the Last American Vagabond and Conscious Resistance, but Derek Brose, B-R-O-E-S, writes, listen to what a volunteer doctor in Gaza has to say about his experience. And there's a lot of them speaking out.
I have never experienced anything like I experienced in Gaza. And I hope that I never do ever again. I'm Andy Ferguson. I'm a GP and public health specialist. And with that work, I've been a regular traveller to both Gaza and the West Bank for the past 14 years. Over Christmas and New Year, I was there as part of a four-person team. We were based at the European Hospital in Khan Yunis for that entire two-week period. Complete chaos reigns. There are about 22,000 people currently living in makeshift tents on the grounds of the hospital or actually on the floors in hospital corridors themselves. You've also got some of the remaining staff living within the hospital, some of them with their families as well.
And that's a huge part of that, by the way. A lot of these doctors are living with their families there. And then their families die when they bomb the hospital or bomb around it. And this keeps happening. And that's why some of these doctors are so overwhelmed with, you know, going on to try to tell people what's happening and all they can do is, do you condemn Hamas? That's all they get.
Within the emergency department particularly, it was chaotic. There were hundreds and hundreds of patients in, you know, in there at any moment, many of them, because the primary healthcare system has broken down, looking for the ongoing management of their diabetes, you know, high blood pressure, heart failure, kidney failure, cancer. And then on top of that, then you get groups of 10, 20, 30 newly injured patients, you know, often with a number of dead bodies arriving within that chaos. By far the greatest number of injuries are those affecting the limbs. You can't imagine really the horror of some of those injuries. People who've had traumatic amputations from the blast itself of arms, legs, the most horrible, complex, devastating fractures, you know, affecting their limbs as well.
Children.
There are chronic shortages of essential equipment, drugs, supplies. Whilst we were there, day by day, those supplies were running out. And on our last day in theatre, Our team themselves used the last dose of morphine and also the last dose of pethidine, so any of those stronger opiate painkillers at that point in time had completely run out. There is intense fighting going on around the European hospital at all times. So throughout the day, whatever you were doing was accompanied by bomb blasts, the sound of tank fire, machine gun fire in the surrounding streets, the level of devastation, the complete dismantling of the health system from the hospitals down to the primary healthcare centres to the vaccination programme and public health initiatives. None of it is functioning.
Every single part of the hospital has been destroyed. The whole infrastructure of the hospital has been destroyed. When I spoke to Marwan yesterday, he told me there were 107 patients still in the hospital, 60 medical staff. God only knows what has happened to them. I think we've seen some of the pictures. Surgeons I know have been executed in the last 48 hours there. Bodies have been discovered in the last 12 to 24 hours who have been handcuffed with their arms behind their back. And so there is no doubt at all that multiple healthcare workers have been executed there in the last few days.
You believe executed by whom, Doctor?
By the Israeli Defence Force.
Why would they seek to execute surgeons and medical professionals?
Well, they've been doing it since October the 7th. Over 450 healthcare workers have been killed. Friends of mine that I have worked with over the years. Many have been abducted as well, and nothing has been heard of them since. So there is no doubt in my mind, and I can bear witness from this from my time at Al-Aqsa Hospital and from talking to people, that there's been direct targeting of the healthcare system in Gaza, direct targeting of hospitals, and multiple killings of healthcare workers.
Any death is tragic, but this is not, and I say again, anyone dying in any sense. So this is not, and please don't be upset by this expression, collateral damage. This is specifically targeted, you're saying, medical professionals by the IDF to be taken off and executed, is your belief?
Most certainly, that is my belief.
Have you at any time seen anything that would lead you to believe that there had been terrorists who were hiding in the hospital?
Without exception, every single one has responded to say they have never witnessed any Hamas militant in the hospitals they have worked in.
It's never ending. You know, I do want to take a moment just, you know, I think it's just seeing some of the comments and so on, you know, that I really want to reiterate that the reason this is all spinning out is because there's change happening. And I know it's a difficult time to recognize that, because it's clearly these dangerous entities are invested in making you uncomfortable so you stop paying attention. The reality being that we need to kind of persevere at this point, because it's an unnerving reality to see the world unfiltered for what it really is, especially when we lived under a guise of something else. But it has to be seen as a positive change, or at the very least that it's an opportunity for us to grab that positive change. So I just want to, I know that we tend to cover really difficult topics, but I just want to stress that all of it stems from a point of which, you know, we're fighting for that positive change. We need to see the problem in order to truly solve it. And I do think it's a positive change right now. I mean, I'm overwhelmed with how many people are seeing things that I've never seen them look at before. So just keep that in mind. I know this can get difficult. We have an amazing community of amazing people who are there, you know, reach out to each other, talk to each other, realize you're not alone. You know, these difficult times, but definitely positive change I see happening right now. Now, on that note, back to terrible things, I guess. But the point being that this is the kind of reality that we're seeing on the ground. But I want to, you know, really, you could look through this whole thread. Yunus Tarawi making, you know, pointing out the reality of them highlighting, you know, that they're going to kill people for no reason. You know, posting stuff on their own pages, showing them stealing stuff from their people's homes, flaunting this stuff, destroying buildings right in front of them as they tell you it's for no reason. Or just the one I show, or giving, you know, haircuts inside of their areas that they've taken over. This one I just think is really transparent. So all you're looking at here is a guy who's with one hand, so clearly not aiming at anything, opening fire on a building, and then showing he's just smoking a cigarette. Turns around, smokes a cigarette, There's no confusing that. That's a war crime, right? He is opening fire on an area without concern about where he's aiming at, where you know there are civilians. And the bottom line in that is that if it's Hamas, or you claim there's Hamas there, or any set, like even removing the idea of the Hamas narrative, if you are not aiming at something deliberately, you are opening fire for no reason in an area where civilians could be, and that is a crime. And it's a small one, guys. It's a tiny example of just how blithe they are, how blasé they are about the whole damn thing. A lot of them, anyway. And I think that's very, very clear. And then here's what Charlie says about this. One can only assume there's a total collapse of leadership and discipline here. A hugely dangerous state of affairs for any military, especially one at war. That's a crazy thing to think about. Now realize, it's not even just the fact that it's happening. These IDF members then filmed it and posted it publicly on their own Instagram, on their own social media. Like, again, that has to really suggest like a complete collapse of leadership. Like, they can't even control these people, or they're promoting it. I don't know which one's worse. I find that to be pretty alarming. Here's another one. This is Muhammad Shihada pointing out that this is just another example, same thing. He simply says, look, just look at how destroyed the city is, he says. Here was a school. He says, you see, here was a school there, and so now there's no school. There's no school this week and in Khan Yunis. There's no school. Everything is destroyed. Just happily praising that. No school for these kids this week. That's what he's saying. And it's all in all its previous wars on Gaza, Israel consistently denied targeting UN schools, shelters, and aid warehouses. Now they show you the reality of that. You don't just go never touching them at all and then bombing 600 mosques, all the UN schools, every UN member, killing everybody involved, and then going, well, Hamas is all there. Don't forget, in the beginning, I think it was the Al-Ali Hospital, if I remember correctly. What happened? It was Hanania Naftali came out and said Hamas, or rather he said it was. He said Hamas was there. Hamas was there. That's why we bombed it. Then, because I guess they didn't get the narrative straight yet, Israel came out and said, nope, it was a Hamas missile that hit it. And Naftali deleted his tweet. That still got remembered. It was publicly displayed. And then every single one since, what they say? Hamas was there. So then why'd they so aggressively deny the first one if the same narrative would have fit? They just decided to move with it. That's why. Alon Mizrahi points out something that I wanted. Actually, you know what? I think I will skip this. I'm 95% sure we're going to do a show tomorrow. If not, it'll be the next day. I've got an interview with David Icke tomorrow, which I might not play tomorrow. So depending on how that works, I usually record them and then put them out the next day. But depending on how that works, that's my deciding factor on whether the show will be tomorrow. I will be talking about this and some other things. I know I often say that I'll be getting to something, and sometimes it doesn't happen. That's just because there's so much going on. I genuinely mean that I will. It just doesn't happen. But when I have it already worked out, highlighted, and ready, I almost never don't get to it. Double negative. But the point is that I will put this off, and it's going to be a conversation about a couple of different important things, both a propaganda, what I see as an effort to manipulate and debunk truthful things, but also a conversation about the humanitarian aid. But I do want to just end up with this point about the kitchen. Yeah, that is the last one. The World Central Kitchen conversation. Just end with this. Oh, and again, I will be getting back to that geoengineering conversation that I was going to start with today. So that's all going to be coming up soon. But to finish, I just wanted to highlight this. In case you didn't see it, just like we expected, they concluded their investigation, assuming that's what it even was, because we don't get to see anything. Just like I told you, they say, we did it. We presented it internally to our people. We're just going to relay via text what the information found. Well, then you didn't do an investigation that we can prove, so you didn't do one. That just as that's the default reality. Even if we don't get to see it, we can't prove it. It doesn't mean anything. One, because you've lied about everything this whole time, but because why would we trust a government when they're the one investigating themselves? It's the same point they make about Russia. I'm not saying Russia good guy or that we should trust one over the other. I doubt all of them. But what does Russia do consistently? At least gives you something you could look over. Sure, they could be lying about it, but they give you something to say, here's our investigation. Here's what we found. Here's why we even want to present it to the UN. And usually they get blocked from doing so, which also makes it very clear. So my point is, they said, we concluded the investigation, and I'll even show you what they said. And guess what? We investigated ourselves. We found ourselves not guilty. Before we get to that, I thought this was funny. somebody posted this, and it just simply says Adam Johannes, Secretary Cardiff Stop the War Coalition. But do you tell me that this is not exactly what's always happened, but is especially happening now? What it says is Israel's style of public relations. A quick guide to Israel PR methods. Number one, we haven't heard reports of deaths. We'll check into it. Number two, the people were killed, but by a faulty Palestinian rocket. Number three, okay, we did kill them, but they were terrorists. Number four, okay, they were civilians, but they were being used as human shields. Number five, okay, there were no fighters in the area, so it was our mistake. We apologize, but we kill civilians by accident, but they do it on purpose. Number six, okay, we kill far more civilians than they do, but look at how terrible other countries are. Or look at the U.S. did it. You didn't complain then. Same thing. Number seven, why are you still talking about Israel? Are you some kind of anti-Semite? Why are you focusing on us? Obviously, guys. And as it says, test this against the next interview you hear or watch. It will be shockingly uncanny. It's exactly what happens. Almost point by point. How can you know that if that's an honest response? Now, we just talked about this. I mentioned earlier. Read this if you have not. Haaretz, Israel created kill zones in Gaza. Anyone who crosses into them is shot. And I'll just read you the opening here. It says, the defense officials and soldiers, however, tell Haaretz that these invisible lines are often, excuse me, let's read it. Defense officials and soldiers tell Haaretz that these are often civilians whose only crime was to cross an invisible line drawn by the IDF. Maybe this one too. It says, in practice, a terrorist is anyone the IDF has killed in the areas which we are operating. How in the world can we not see what that means? They're killing civilians and they're calling them Hamas. Now, here is what Cuts News Network posted. I do think this one's important. This is Saeed Erekat doing the great job he's always doing, making Matt Miller look like the fool that he is, and showing you he's lying with an IDF statement, as usual anyway.
One last one, if I may. Are you aware of a report made or a conversation that Israeli officers made an interview with Haaretz, where they say that Israel established some sort of an illusory, you know, kill zone line and so on? Are you aware of that? And they actually kill whoever walks or moves about in that area?
I read that article and I noted that in it, the IDF says that of course is not what they have established. There are, of course.
Okay, so you read the article, which cited all sorts of IDF insiders, public information, their own research, right? Journalists on the ground, they had documents, or rather images and stuff. There's all sorts of stuff in that article. The point is, he goes, but IDF said it didn't happen. That's genuinely what he's saying. Yeah, I read the article. Just disregarding all of the evidence in that article because Israel commented and said, that's not true. You know what else they said wasn't true? Blocking aid. You know what else they said wasn't true? Targeting civilians. You know what else they said wasn't true? Literally every other dynamic of this entire conversation. But that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. Matt doesn't care because he's not here to tell you the truth.
Areas of significant combat where any civilian could wander in and be unfortunately be killed either by fire from Israel or by fire
about.
From Hamas if you walk into an active conflict zone.
Oh, now you're just going to blame Hamas too, even though they told you they're shooting people, that they're ordered to fire on anybody that comes into these areas? It's not just a war area. It's a line that's drawn that is kill anyone that walks into it, including our own people, which happened.
That's a possibility. But I have noted that the IDF said they have not, of course, established kill zones. It would be incredibly inappropriate for anything like that to be established. And we've not seen evidence at this point that they have.
Not seen evidence except all the evidence in that article. You see, what he means by evidence is what Israel says and what we say we've seen, like the State Department investigation and then what Israel tells us. Apparently, according to Kirby, literally nothing else matters. Hey, videos, documents, you know, whistleblowers, who cares? Because in our investigation, we haven't seen anything that proves they've broken the law. That's what he just said. And they're over here waving evidence. Look at this video. They just killed these people. Well, and state departments looked at each one of them and we have not found evidence. That's what he said. So they don't, nothing matters if we look at it and we just disagree. We have a different opinion. So we investigated ourselves. We found ourselves not guilty is the narrative they have. Now, here is a clip that was put out before that. And here's Jas pointing out State Department spokesperson, are you talking crap? This was published months ago. Now, it's a Spanish channel for those in the podcast. The point is the same. It's an IDF member that was speaking on the record, like we've seen many times, telling you, we have this line. Now, we just shouldn't need this, because this is the same as the other seven sources in the Haaretz article from Haaretz corporate media. It's hilarious, the things they will ignore or sidestep.
Por las víctimas civiles, por las decenas de miles de muertos palestinos, mujeres, niños.
Ahí no hay inocentes.
So there are no innocents. We have to get that into our heads.
No hay inocentes.
No innocents. That's an IDF.
La misión principal de la brigada de Yehuda.
The main mission of Yehud, of Israel's brigade, has been to help divide the Gaza Strip into two parts.
Clearly. La franja de Gaza en dos partes.
Yeah, says, we have already divided the south and north, and no one can approach that area. What else would you call that? This, by the way, after Netanyahu is telling them they can go back to the north. Get shot.
Nadie puede acercarse a esa zona.
He says, if they approach, we kill. That's the reality, guys. Next, here is James O'Brien, just in a very tactful, the best way I've seen. Simply putting it to this person who's another one of these lackeys who's trying to defend that somehow a deliberate attack is not deliberate when the people we aimed at get killed. It's baffling, the willful ignorance, but I think we all know it's just lies.
Call it collateral damage, mate. There's what, 8,000-9,000 dead children? It's a deliberate killing of 30,000 Palestinian people in the hope of catching some terrorists in that net. That's not collateral damage.
True. You're not providing any logic for that. It's not deliberate.
I'm giving you the number. So who fired guns by accident? Who launched missiles by accident? What's the opposite of accident?
I don't understand.
I guess someone's saying Yehud means Jewish brigade. I thought that was either. I thought Yehud always was like Jew or Israel translated sometimes, but I guess that someone in the chat is saying that means a specific brigade. So just clarification.
Opposite of accident. What's the opposite of accident?
I don't understand.
The opposite of accident is deliberate. So either these missiles were fired by accident or they were fired deliberately. If they were fired deliberately in the full knowledge that countless civilians were going to be killed in the process, the killing of the civilians is deliberate.
You can't deny that logic. And you know you can't. Nobody can. You can simply say that you didn't want it to happen, but you chose to do it anyway. That, at least, I would accept, because you can't do it by accident. If you're like, okay, there's 400 civilians there, we think there's a commander, and we choose to launch that missile that will kill the 400, going for the one. Remember, they publicly said that, and now I think that was one of the first times they realized they had stepped too far. Shockingly enough, anyway, because they should have known right at the beginning. The point is that even Wolf Blitzer was like, what? Like, you can't just murder 400 people. And then it turned out he wasn't even there. So you can't call that an accident when you chose to kill them. But you could argue that you grudgingly did so, or you had to. But you can't say it's an accident. But that's what they're doing.
The full knowledge that countless civilians were going to be killed in the process, the killing of the civilians is deliberate.
I wouldn't agree that.
Talk me through the reasons why. Talk me through what the problems in the logic.
Well, for the same reason that if I decide to paint my bedroom with red paint and spill it on the floor, I spilt it. My intention wasn't to spill it on the floor. It just unfortunately happened as a consequence because I'm klutzy.
I don't know if...
Before he just ruins this guy, I mean, obviously that doesn't apply, right? Because you didn't accidentally fire on the civilians. You chose to. So this would be like having 10 people in front of you stand there, and only one of them you want to get paint on, and you throw it at all of them, and you go, well, I accidentally hit the rest of you. No, you didn't. You threw it at all of us. That's the point. It's just embarrassing the way these people try to manipulate, because, you know, some people just don't have the same kind of deductive logic, and so they fall for these things. The truth is, I think most people see it. Now, the way he just dismantles this guy, it's hilarious, but it's really this easy if you just care about pushing back.
On the floor, it just unfortunately happened as a consequence, because I'm klutzy.
I don't know if I can even come down to that level of discourse, but I will, out of respect for you, Michael.
Thank you. I was like it when you dumb it down for me.
Well, I'm not dumbing it down. I'm a little bit disgusted by the analogy because we're talking about dead children and you're comparing them to spilt paint. But let's ignore that analogy. Let's leave the spilt paint out of it. If you launch a missile knowing that it's going to kill civilians, is the killing of those civilians deliberate or accidental?
It's neither. It's not, well, it's not deliberate. It is a consequence.
Okay, so let me say it again. You deliberately launch a missile knowing that civilians will die. Is the killing of the civilians deliberate?
No, it's a consequence. It's a consequence, but it's not the main
purpose. Is it a deliberate consequence?
A deliberate consequence.
Wow.
It's not the intention.
But it's going to happen, so it is the intention.
Yes.
See?
Well, it's not the intention.
It is the intention. You know it's going to happen.
This is just language. There's no way around it.
Well, that's the difference between... That's not what an intention means.
Okay.
If there was another way, they would do it.
Wow. Yeah, it is what intention means. You chose to do it. It happened. They're trying to over... Just like with the whole situation of the occupation of Palestine. It's actually not that complicated. It's about trying to make it overly complicated so people just go, whatever... I guess I don't understand. And just check out. It's very clear. There's no way you can't see that. And I do think that was well done. Now, here's Muhammad Shihada pointing out. Surprise! The IDF officer fired for the killing of the seven World Central Kitchen aid workers is a West Bank settler. Big surprise. He got a box of chocolate from the settler council's head to celebrate him after he's done. Many IDF commanders are just genocidal settlers in uniform. Not a joke, by the way. In addition to the chocolate box and warm hugs he got from the settlement council leader after getting fired for the killing of humanitarian workers, Israeli ministers have been voicing strong support for him, demanding his reinstatement. That's not a joke. I mean, there's just no misunderstanding this, guys. That's incredibly disgusting. Now here, well, first of all, a mother of one of the Canadian aid workers is apparently rejecting outright Israel's explanation, which shouldn't surprise anybody. But here is what they said. Get ready to be disgusted, to be outraged, to laugh. April 5th, conclusion of the investigation. So it simply says the investigation found that by the way, everything else before this and everything that I highlighted is meaningless fluff nonsense. It's just, it has nothing to do with what the investigation found. But it gets to the final point that says the investigation found that the forces identified a gunman on one of the aid trucks, which followed, they identified an additional gunman. Right, so you're telling us you were, as I'm jumping a point that somebody else made, but that you weren't able to see what the cars were because it was nighttime. So you weren't able to see a gigantic, large emblem on the sides and top of the cars, even though you've got night vision, even though you've got all sorts of other surveillance equipment, so you're obviously lying, but you somehow then were able to see guns in their hands inside those cars. That perfectly makes sense. This is how bad they actually are at this. I don't even understand how you couldn't make a better excuse than this. It says, after the vehicles left the warehouse where the aid had been unloaded, one of the commanders mistakenly assumed the gunmen were located inside the accompanying vehicles and that these were Hamas terrorists. So now we're basically saying, at one point here, undefined, because, you know, we don't get to see the actual investigation, which I doubt even exists. Their quote investigation was them around a table deciding what they were going to write down. That's my opinion. But the point is that you then assumed that a gun that you say you saw in the first place after it was unloaded was somehow in the car going forward. So that's all you need to bomb three separate locations, kilometers apart, full of people repeatedly, is the assumption of one gun. I mean, do they not realize that that is in and of itself admitting a crime? Apparently not. But it says, the forces did not identify the vehicles in question as being associated with the World Central Kitchen. Yeah, but somehow saw a gun in their hand inside the car, because that makes sense. Even though there wasn't one, guys, that's also the point. It says, following a misidentification by the forces, again, just oopsie, we made a quick mistake. Maybe that was your AI systems that no one's paying attention to, but we won't make that point today. It says, the forces targeted the three vehicles. But no, guys, see, this is the way they're playing this. They targeted one vehicle, it was a different vehicle, but they targeted one vehicle, bombed it. They got out of that vehicle, the ones that didn't die. They then went to another vehicle and then drove. And we're talking about kilometers in between each one of them. Then started driving again. Then they bombed them again. Then they got out of the car, went to another car, and they bombed them a third time. Not three vehicles in one bombing. They're trying to conflate this. this is why it's so clear that they're lying. And it says, where was that? Following the they targeted the vehicles based on misclassification of the events and the vehicles as having Hamas operatives inside them. What evidence? This is supposed to be an investigation, right? Where's the information? You just say we saw a gun? Well, then why would you assume they were Hamas? Just because there's a gun? That's not everyone with a gun is Hamas. We see the point is this is not an investigation. And if you're literally admitting to us that you just bomb people for the minor reasons, in fact, just being a male, which they've already been in that very article we just pointed to, they admitted that. It says, with the resulting strike leading to the deaths of 7 innocent humanitarian aid workers, which, by the way, is 7 in a string of 1,000 innocent people that have been killed in Gaza. One is no more important than the other, whether they are American, British, or Canadian, or Palestinian, or Israeli. They're human lives. Those who approved the strike were convinced, they say, that they were targeting armed Hamas operatives. Why were they convinced? You didn't explain that because this is an investigation. There's no data. This is you narrative setting. That's all this is. Because the point is, if you were convinced, well, that means there was evidence, but there wasn't. You said you saw a gun. That's it. The brigade fire support commander, an officer with the rank of major, will be dismissed. Again, that's it, guys. There's more of them. My point is, that's, remember the joke I make all the time? I commit murder. Can I quit my job and be like, okay, I resign in disgrace. Am I good? In what world does that make sense? I don't care if it was an accident or not. Seven people died. And you're just going to go, you're fired, and then get a box of chocolates and get praised and probably get re-put in your position about a month later, which probably will happen. Because the extreme level of the extreme government, the Ben-Gavirs of the world, they are desperately trying to put that guy back in place because they're proudly saying he did the right thing right now. It says, additionally, the brigade commander and the 662nd Division commander will be formally reprimanded. Ooh. The IDF chief of staff decided to formally reprimand the commander. That's it. That's literally all that will happen. And ask yourself, why are you even reprimanding them if all that happened was there was a mistake made? You said they saw a gun. They made a mistake. Based on your logic, that's enough. So shouldn't you be going, they did the right thing. They just ended up being the wrong choice. No, they want you to think there's accountability. So they reprimand them for things that they tell them to do. But guess what? They're not really being reprimanded. That's it. That's it. That's the investigation. And that's what Asaf MD says. That's it. That's the best you've got after days of investigating? That days, by the way, it takes days to do that. He says, you thought you saw a gun, a single gun possibly, and you exterminate 7 people? Yes. He also adds, they saw a gun at night, but not the massive signs on the cars. Got it. Thanks for investigating. Well, here's what Norman Finkelstein wrote. Let me do this, actually. Wrap this up quickly here just to get that at the end. I want to add as well, Nathan Robinson points out, Israel has killed, so to pretend like this is an accident is so insulting. Israel has killed more aid workers in the Gaza Strip than have died in all of the countries and the rest of the world combined in any of the last 30 years. That's flooring. And this is what they say. This is a war of superlatives. Was that the word they used? You know, just of extremes. We're talking about the idea of the most children killed, the most journalists, the most aid workers. I mean, how are we still pretending this is not what it looks like? Now, I know I'm still speaking to the minority here. I know the vast majority of the world does, but I'm just blown away that this can still continue. What do they have? But look at the numbers. And skip past the screenshot, because you know we're better than that. Here's the article itself. And no, I wouldn't just trust New York Times either. The information is clear. Now, because of this, you've got a source you can track it back to. And yes, this is the actual information. And this is just in the Gaza and the West Bank. That's red. Look at that. That's more than the entire rest of the world in all of that time frame. That'd be 2022 right there. 2023 and then 2024. There's no misunderstanding that. That's not a bunch of accidents or Hamas members. That's murder. Now, I'm going to skip this too, but I'll include it. It's just a funny clip. This guy's basically showing you. It's just hilarious. Watch. Well, I mean, let me see. It's only, I'll skip it because I already said I would. The point is, he's basically just making a point. How he goes, I only mourn the deaths. for crying out loud. I just want to play it now. I'm so bad about that. I can't see. This is why it's so hard for me to do these shows short, because I just like, ah, just get to it. Just talk about it. Now I'm wasting 30 more seconds doing this right now. So let's play this clip. It's funny. It is a parody. Let's put it that way before I play it, because, oh, actually, and I want, before I play that, I want to play this too, because this is about the quick clip showing you that even the leader of the World Central Kitchen is telling you that he thinks it was deliberate. We already played it.
Is that we were targeted deliberately, nonstop, until everybody was dead in this convoy. This happened over more than 1.5, 1.8 kilometers. So this was not just a bad luck situation where, oops.
All right. That's clear, guys. Very clear. Now, I'll play this, and then we're going to wrap this up. It's just funny. So this is what you see in regard to the blind followers of Israel, where they say they're outraged only based on the instruction. Or, you know, it's kind of the same as I support the current thing. But this is what you're seeing online.
Hey, guys. Today is a really tragic day for me and for all of my liberal Zionist brothers and sisters out there. Those aid workers at the World Kitchen who died tragically in an accidental targeted bombing.
It's just
one of those things that is just unavoidable. And I, you know, as Zionists, I think we all need to pause for a moment and realize that, like, the collateral damage is not good, and is, in fact, can be bad. You know, I'm praying for them and for all their families. And got a notification.
Perfect.
Israel. Oh, they're Hamas. They're Hamas. They deserve to die. It's good that they're dead. And it's tragic to say, but I hope their families die too. Sorry. That was a different thing. That was a different thing. No, this is tragic.
This is so disgusting.
The Israeli government is saying officially that this is sad. So I think it's sad that this happened. unless there's something else that comes to light later.
I mean, that's just so I hate even laughing about that, because it's so stupid. It's so real. I mean, and look, it's not even just this topic, guys. This is two-party illusion stuff right there. And it's the worst of them, you know, the most followers. But it's just to be on cue, like, turns out their mom, Israel said, just because that thing popped up on my screen from a site that I claim I trust, you know, that's so real. And it's alarming how much that's happening. But at one last point, just to remember that Al-Shifa, by the way, was also a huge dynamic that a lot of these stories got buried. Eclipsed by the also very serious attack on seven individuals. But the point is that a lot more people were killed in Al-Shifa and other situations. I mean, or even close to the same amount of people were killed in the bombing of the Iranian embassy, right? These are huge events. So just make sure we don't miss sight of how big this last series of events were. And as Aaron Mate writes, Israel's murder of seven aid workers overshadowed the destruction of Gaza's largest hospital and murder of its people inside. And here's the video of it. Just Tedros pointing out that this is just the backbone of the area and destroyed. You know, it's just funny how just pointing to Tedros makes certain people get angry. It's just funny. I don't support Tedros. I think he's a maniac and I think he's a liar, but doesn't change the fact that what he's pointing at is true. It's just funny how people can't look past certain things. But here is the image of Al-Shifa, which is shocking, guys. This is the inside of this hospital. You tell me why this was necessary. I mean, you know what's going on. It was destroyed because these people wanted to destroy the hospital. But under the guise that this was only going after Hamas, or ridiculous schmooly out there saying they pinpoint target Hamas. Tell me how this is pinpoint anything. That's Al-Shifa Hospital. My God. Before this, it was the largest example of something that was still maintaining treatment. Now it's gone. Unreal. Just unreal. And Francesca Albanese, UN Special Rapporteur, says medical shielding, interesting, so basically human shields, but with a medical facility, has been the backbone of Israel's genocidal violence in Gaza. And she points to her own report, Anatomy of a Genocide, which is right here, which is a very important one that you should read. Guys, they have lost this. It's very clear. That's not an indication of anything other than the Zionist agenda and its very clear crimes finally being exposed. Arnab Batrand writes, and this kind of overarching point that we're making today, it's truly breathtaking. Last week, they were all on board for the genocide, defunding UNRWA and defending Israel tooth and nails. And now this letter randomly comes out. 40 members of Congress, including people like Nancy Pelosi, just sent Biden a 180-degree shift. It's basically like reading what everybody else has been saying for 5 months. There's just no way you could take that seriously. That's my point. What shifted? What changed? Could just be that they realize they just can't keep hemorrhaging support. But I think it's something else. They wouldn't go 5 months into losing all of their support and then change. It would have happened earlier if it was just their decision. Something changed. That's my opinion. But he writes, and all it took was really their favorite DC chef getting personally affected. Now, maybe there's something there that happened further. I don't think just that would do it. He goes, even the most cynical parody of the U.S. political system couldn't have thought of that one. And you could read the article for the writing for yourself. I don't take it at face value. Now, let's see. Let's finish with this. This is not an interview. She writes, this is a masterpiece. And this is a fantastic statement by Bassem Youssef, the comedian and you know commentator.
Family in Gaza, your wife's family, your in-laws are there, right?
Yes.
And tell me, can you talk to them?
No, I mean, I've been touring, so it's been difficult. It's been difficult enough for them to be in touch with my wife and her family. But the thing is, they have like many families there, like cousins and uncles, and they all left their houses in Khan Yunis and Gaza and northern Gaza. And now they are in one apartment, in one building in Rafah, sharing it with 25 other families. And, you know, at any moment we can hear a bomb drop. But it's okay because Israel will apologize, I'm sure, as they usually do. I mean, like, I was so happy to listen to their sincere apology for killing the people from Central Kitchen. Oh, my God. Like, the pain that they have to go through. I mean, even like one of their spokesmen tweeted on Twitter, it's like, see what Hamas made me do. Like, it is
my God.
So interesting. And the thing is, what's really, for me, what's very interesting is the outrage, the global outcry. It's like, oh, how could you do that, Israel? But it's like every time it's like, oh, Hamas did it. Oh, we did it. We're so sorry. There will be absolutely no accountability of what they did in Gaza for the past 6 months. This is what pains me.
Do you not think the tone is changing, given the mounting death toll?
Slightly,
in Gaza?
But it is performative rage.
Yes.
Like the world reader are so enraged about Israel killing the 7 workers. And you know, we talk about that, but I find that there's more rage about killing 7 foreign workers more than the rage about killing 30,000 Palestinians.
Right.
Look,
remember when we
said that.
Remember when 30,000 was too much? Remember when 3,000 Palestinians was too much? Yeah. You know what happened? 3,000. You know, tomorrow, if 300,000 Palestinians kill, nobody will care. Nobody will care. Numbers don't mean anything.
Why do you think that is?
Because they don't look at Palestinians as equal human beings.
Yep. Exactly that. And they're working to try to convince the world of the same. And they're failing. They're failing. But I'll leave you with this clip, the same point. It's important not to let this ploy work. Now, lean into the positive aspects of it. It's good that they're saying things that we can prove are true. But do not get swayed by how clearly they're trying to convince you that they're suddenly on the right side. Because that will only set you in a position to fail again. As Caitlin Johnstone writes, opposition to the slaughter in Gaza appears to be getting more mainstream, which is obviously great. But when political impulses go mainstream, it means there's going to be a massive and concerted effort to funnel public sentiment in a direction that doesn't damage the interests of the empire. 100%. Now, I'm going to leave you with this clip on the way out. Important, guys, that this topic in particular get highlighted. I'm going to try to have Jason make a clip of just the Rwanda focus, because I think that's really important, or really just the funding of dangerous regimes focus. Make sure that gets out there. But clip it up for yourself. Tag me on Twitter or elsewhere, or Gab or whatever ever else you use, and I will share it. Right? Make sure you follow us on all these different platforms, Substack and everything else. Continue to support this platform. I'll include in the links down below for our Give, Send, Go monthly recurring campaign that we're working on, to make sure we're trying to get enough recurring donations that go through month to month. So make sure you check that out. And I will be getting back. I just wrote it down today. I'm going to be setting up one of these, our founding meetings for Substack in the next couple of days. It might not be like right away, but I'll give you guys time to be set up for that. But if you want to join Substack as a founding member, I'm going to be setting up another one of these meetings that we'll be doing monthly again, where you guys can talk to me personally. We can ask questions, we can engage. And it's an important, you know, just support mechanism through that right now for TLAV. So thank you for continuing to support us, guys, and continuing to highlight all these things. I think it's tough. You know, I see it. I see it wearing, it wears on me. But I recognize how monumentally important it is. As we just talked about the other day, that clip that I forget who shared that, but it was just, you know, that it's hard. I mean, this makes me feel sad sometimes, and it wears on me. But I remember that they need us. Right. When we, and it's not like our, you know, it's all relative. You know, when you're having a hard time, when you're feeling sad and depressed, you know, it's not like, well, they're in a worse position, so I shouldn't feel that way. You know, own the way you feel. It matters. But recognize that while you're feeling depressed because of how things are bad in life, that there are people literally starving to death and they are fighting. They refuse to give up and they need us. So it's not about guilt. It's about the reality that they need us. And so if we want to fight for this, it's important that we all band together and continue to fight, because without us, they're going to lose. And that goes for any of these situations, because they are in a position where they have been over centuries, or rather in this case specifically, decades. But I mean, you could talk about other locations of just well before the U.S. government of how this has been an ongoing process, but decades of just nonstop oppression. And outsourcing resources and put them in a position where they can't stand up for themselves and nobody wants to hear what they have to say. And so that's where we come into play. Both this platform, you as an individual, and the rest of people out there that care. So it's an important time to realize that we need to be strong for the people that aren't being listened to, for the people with a boot on their neck that nobody cares about. Have the courage to stand up for people that need you. Thank you for being here. I love you all. As always, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant.
Come on.
So do not.
Seeing some civilians nearby. Do it.